Last week. fifth of June.
As a matter of fact, you will recall, Honourable Van der Merwe, because I think you were here at the time, there were just two or three of us present, that we decided not to have the whole program that day and to ensure that we had more members of the committees present. So it was, in theory, going to be last week, and we would have continued until 1:30. But not everyone could be there at that time, and we had a very small committee.
And then
he then gave us the mandate to therefore start a process of amending the 2005, because the inputs that we received from the public were so much enormous that we could not ignore them. We had to undertake the process of amending. Second process that also led to that, at the NEDLAC process, when the NEDLACs were debating issues regarding the cooperative, we demanded that there is a new practices in the market that is taking place, whereby companies like in the textile industry and other industries were beginning to use certain clauses within the Act. If you look at the worker cooperative within the Act, in the 2005 Act, had exempted worker cooperatives from complying with basic conditions of Employment and Labor Relations Act. What then, the unintended consequence of that was that, therefore, companies like in the textile and others, particularly in KZN, started converting their employees into worker co-ops, and thereby, therefore, circumventing complying with the basic conditions of employment as well as the Labor Relations Act. And therefore, that resulted in NEDLAC calling for the department to look at the process of amending the Act itself. And those are the clauses that we're going to deal with in detail today. We then also use this process not only just to deal with some of those issues, but also to develop this bill in such a way that we enhance the development character of the cooperative legislation, we reduce the regulatory burden for cooperatives, and then we enhance compliance, coordination, administration, and sustainability of cooperatives. These were the three core fundamental drivers that enabled us to amend the 2005 Act with this particular bill. Now, I'm getting into now the core of the areas that we amended. If we look at the first area, which is the reserve fund, it is under the reserve fund, it is under Section 3, page 5 of the Act, and also Section 46 and page 13. You will see that there were no clear guidelines on people's reporting and use of the reserve fund in the 2005. The reserve fund, what it called for was that all cooperatives must set aside 5% of the reserves, but it didn't tell how should these reserves be utilized, in what manner should they be utilized, and then what are the practices that are disallowable within the reserve fund. And therefore, every cooperative in that regard was required to do that. And also what this thing did, the 5%, bigger cooperative complained to the DTI, arguing that this is more or less for them a taxation. They are in any manner putting reserve funds, but they decide this reserve fund in their businesses. If we are forcing them to put a 5%, for them, the base is huge. I mean, you'll find that some of the cooperatives are in the billion mark in terms of the revenues. So they are saying 5% is a very stiff amount for them to be put aside as reserves. And therefore, in that way, it created those kinds of anomalies. Particularly, so we amended that section. The current version of the amendment says that every cooperative must have a reserve fund, and then we're saying that members themselves within the cooperative will decide and stipulate the limits to be kept as reserve in their constitution of the cooperative. So what we have done, instead of...
Just a minute. Just let's get the bill that you're reading from. We've got two here. You're looking at one. Am I correct? Co-ops one.
Yeah, this one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you've got two.
75, yeah.
Yeah, just give us the number at the bottom. B17.
Yeah, B17.
Right, now give us the page.
It's page, section 3, page 5.
And then give us the number, because I see one or two people like me paging through.
Yeah, you could see there, amendment of section 3 of Act 14 of 2005.
That's
the first
clause. Now we're
clause.
All on board.
Yeah, that's the first clause that is impacted today. And then the second one, it will be section 46, page 13. So you must look at those jointly, all right, because they are interrelated, all right. Page 13. All right. You're looking at both those two because they are related. They're speaking to one and the same thing. Now, as you could see there, if we take the first one, it says at least a percentage of the surplus is set aside as a reserve and is not divisible among its members. So, meaning that we are now saying that the cooperative must have a reserve fund. That's the first law. And then if you follow there, we're saying that the constitution of a category C primary, secondary, or national affairs corp may provide that members have more. No, that one is the voting rights, more than one vote, but this is deals with only one with votes. But if you proceed now to page 13, you will see that during each financial year, corporate must set aside reserves that are indivisible among its members. Every corporate must retain the percentage of the surplus as determined in its constitution for each financial year in its reserve fund, unless such reserve are equivalent to 5% or more of its net assets. The minister must, by notice, provide guidelines for the manner in which reports in respect of the reserves and the reserve funds must be kept, the purpose for which any of the reserve may be used, and the manner in which a corporate must report on the purpose for which the reserve have been used. So those are the clauses that we've put in. We've set up, we've moved now from prescribing the percentage to say 5% must be set aside. We're saying the members themselves must decide what percentage, but we're saying that they could, if they've decided, if they've reached a 5% of the surplus, then they could now stop and not comply. They will be regarded as having complied in that regard. But we're not prescribing in that particular regard. And
my apology, Comité, but I have not caught up properly. I am aware of page 6 of 46.
Let me help you here, because that's what I was trying to get at earlier. We need to refer to, in the one document, B17, which I'm sure you have. Have you got B17 at the bottom on your left?
Yeah.
I don't think you do. You see, so I wonder if we can ask someone just to make one of these available. It's important that the chairperson of the subcommittee really keeps up with you. So I'm sure you don't mind while we make sure.
We don't.
Okay, let's just get that for you. Yes. So then as soon as you've got that one, you're going to be looking at B17-2012. Just check the bottom left. And then page 5. And that will be amendment of section 3, act 14-2005, halfway down. Do you see that? And then I think it was section 3 there that we were referring to, which is related to slide 4, the one that is up. And then at the same time, we were referring to cross-referencing onto page 13 of the same one, page 13, and that is a substitution of section 46 of Act 14-2005, 33, and just below that you'll see the 46. Are we on board then? Okay. So if we can go ahead then. And the problem is when we've got a lot of bills in front of us, we're not too sure which one is being referred
to. Thank you for
your patience.
We're going to be very patient, the chairperson, and because we want everybody to be on board, it's very important. Thanks. And therefore, we are providing guidelines. Where the minister is going to be providing guidelines to just guide cooperatives on what are the things that they could more or less use or utilize this reserve fund for. It's not a prescription, it's more like to guide them. We're not dictating to them where they should use and where they should not use. We're saying these are the guidelines, these are the areas we will guide you that to use this particular reserve fund. It's more, the reserve funds are used more in terms of if the cooperatives are in financial crisis or they want to achieve further investment into the cooperative. They want to build up further investment into the cooperatives. It's more like in the company where you have this, what we call it, the shares that are not retained in term, which are kept for further investment. It plays that similar. Pillar Rule here within the cooperative. I beg your pardon, sir?
Retained earnings.
Yeah, retained earnings. Yeah.
It was just suggesting the word to use, they used it, we move on.
Okay, all right, thanks. And then now, I think that point we've covered, and Chairperson, we're going to go to the next one now, which is the voting rights. There, we're looking at section 3, subsection 3, and then subsection 4 and subsection 5, which is also page 5, the same page, which is the first page that we had, which is page 5. In fact, I was jumping into that area earlier on. As you could see there, the challenge here was that the 2005 Act compelled all cooperatives to use what we call it one person, one vote. Meaning all the various categories of cooperatives are to comply with one person, one vote. This was derived, it was not an error, but it was derived from the International Cooperative Alliance, which is a practice and it's one of the global principles that are very classic within the global the cooperative movement. But within the South African context, it created some problems. The cooperatives that were established during 1980, the post-2005 Act, had already, particularly the GROM, that already created what you call it voting rights that are based on contribution by members. So if members are contributing in terms of the transaction, 70%, 40%, 30%, then their voting rights will be given in congruence with their business transaction they are making with the cooperatives. And therefore, what that does is created some challenges because those cooperatives that were formed during that period were trying that all of a sudden they are made illegal with their practices of the voting rights, insisting that we must do a one person one vote. And then they were trying that this will undermine the current status within the cooperatives, and it might even force these cooperatives to convert into companies or move and then abandon the cooperative altogether. And therefore, it also for them, it was an issue that undermines growth because the bigger the cooperatives that do business are the ones that are sustaining the cooperatives because they've got higher volumes of business transactions, and therefore cooperatives derive those incomes from those that have a bigger volume of transactions. And therefore, and the other issue as well that we needed to take on board was that within the secondary cooperatives and the national APEC, if you are going to insist on one person, one vote, the unintended consequence that you will create is that primary cooperatives differ in membership at the primary level. You might have primary cooperatives that have 100 members, others have about 200, others have 300 members. So if you insist on one person, one vote, you are saying, therefore, that cooperatives that differ in terms of membership must also enjoy just one vote, whereas they have got bigger members that they are servicing. Therefore, why should they not enjoy a bigger say within that particular cooperative at a secondary level so that that is in congruence with the membership that they have, and then in that way enhancing democracy in the process because it will create a perverse of democracy at the level of secondary cooperatives. And then taking all of those considerations on board, then we then amended those clauses that were there in 2005. The current clauses really stipulated that the constitution of category C, primary, secondary, and national apostolic may provide that members may have more than one vote, but subject to certain limits. We limited that to 15%. And then we say cooperatives registered prior to 2005 may retain their voting rights as per their constitutions. So meaning that if they were enjoying these voting rights before, they retained them moving forward. Only the ones that are going to be subjected to this law are the ones that are going to be registered under this amendment those would have to comply in terms of the new, that is, formulations that we've put forward. Those are the essence of the amendment that we've put forward in this area. I don't know whether that's clear. So as you can see there in subsection 3, the Constitution of Category C, primary, secondary, or national affairs corp, may provide that the members have more than one vote, unless if a cooperative has three members, no member has voting rights in excess of 40%, four members, no members has voting rights in excess of 30%, and five or more members, no members have voting rights in excess of 25%. And the Constitution of Category C may provide that members have more than one vote, provided no member shall have more than 15% of the vote of all the members of the cooperative. Voting rights in respect of Category C, primary cooperative and secondary cooperative registered in terms of applicable legislation prior to the commencement of this Act are regulated by the provision on voting rights contained in its Constitution as it was immediately prior to the commencement of this Act. The principle of corporate governance are applicable to all cooperatives which fall under this Act. So, those are the areas. So, I'll move to the next issue, members, chairperson. Primary cooperative. Here, the issue here was around how do you establish the primary cooperative or how do you form the primary cooperative. This is in section C, page 6. Section C, which is page 6 of the current Act. The 2005 Act stipulated that only five natural persons can establish primary cooperatives. And then later on, allowed juridic persons to join in. But it was not clear that what was that meaning? And then what did happen is that the way it was formulated, it was not clear whether they should join, whether they should start. So we have corrected this issue because this issue has had an adverse impact on the cooperative. I just want to see a bit if members could allow me. The fact that we've forced primary cooperatives to be 5 natural persons, it meant that, first, the juristic persons, which are not necessarily, if you take, for example, in the agricultural setting, you will find that most farmers will have trust. They will, their farms will be kept on trust. Some they will have farms owned individually. Others they could be in other forms of juristic persons. But while they are owning these farms through these instruments, they then want to come in under a cooperative to create a cooperative that will assist them for marketing purposes or for purchasing inputs into their farm on a collective scale so that they can reduce costs and be able to achieve competitiveness in that regard. This, the Act, therefore, was in a way, and also you will have cooperatives that are mixed, that are both juristic, a natural person, others will be purely juristic, others will be purely natural persons. What the Act only stipulated was one formula. Only natural persons should only be within the primary cooperative as the 2005. And this then created a problem. So what we then opened it up was to allow natural persons to, 5 natural persons to start the cooperative and then also allow 2 juristic persons to start the primary cooperatives or a combination of 5 persons. This is in line with the international practices all over the world in any way, whereby the definition of the cooperative at this moment, if you want to just look at the definition of the cooperative, what is a cooperative? That definition looks at cooperative is an association of persons voluntarily coming together to either meet the economic, cultural, and social needs. It doesn't talk natural. It doesn't refer to juristic. It talks to persons. And therefore, it acknowledges both natural as well as juristic persons within the definition. What we then did in South Africa, we created a bit of a pivot because we only gave that right at the primary level to only natural persons, which then meant that it would have started the development and growth of cooperatives. Because in some instances, cooperatives that are started, let's say, by natural persons could also be able to mobilize juristic persons and get resources and be able to have exposed to high levels of technology, high levels of skills, and all the issues and all the benefits that goes with that kind of a combination. But also what this thing did is that it therefore made it impossible for us to grow cooperatives. Most of the cooperatives that we formed, members, after 2005 are just either small, vulnerable, they are not growing because they are not taking advantage of the cooperative, which is to come together, converge, and create economies of scale. Because the act itself made it impossible. This could only take place at the level of secondary cooperatives, which even there at secondary cooperatives, which are saying only two primary cooperatives could come together. Whereas the convergence should be able to take place right at the level of primary. And then in that way, you are able to create economies of scale right at the level of primary. Therefore, it is in that regard that we've amended this particular clause so that we can allow development and growth of cooperatives, and then in that way, the economies of scale could fully be taken advantage of by cooperatives. I'm proceeding now to the next one, which is the vertical structure. That one is in section 6, is also in page 6, same page, which we are not moving forward on that page. What we're saying here is that secondary cooperatives can be formed by primary cooperatives that are operational. So in that way, if we looked at the 2005 Act, it allowed secondary cooperatives indeed to be formed by primary cooperatives, but what it didn't emphasize was that these primary cooperatives must be operational. What you are now having in the market at the moment is that you have members of communities forming secondary cooperatives without having operational primary cooperatives. So in that way, then it defeats the whole purpose, because why would you want to form a secondary cooperative that lacks, you've got primary cooperatives that are already in business, who then through the primary cooperatives, it has come out from them. It should have come from the primary cooperatives, the need to establish the secondary cooperatives. Then, but you find that you've got service providers in the market who are going around in the country forming these secondary cooperatives. That is why we've got a high failure rate, particularly on cooperatives, because some of the secondary cooperatives are not formed on the economic rationality. They're just formed as a structure at the level, either geographical purposes, without taking into cognizance that they should be, before you form a secondary cooperative, operational primary cooperative, that they've got shared needs. And then based on those shared economic needs, then a secondary cooperative could emerge. So we are therefore insisting on the operational aspect so that we can discipline the market to be able to create secondary cooperatives primarily informed by economic rationality as well as also informed by the needs that are flowing from already operating primary cooperatives rather than some of the instances you find that these things are formed only just to access money for government. Through the secondary cooperatives, because it has been found that there is a grant and then people form these secondary cooperatives for that purpose, and then the actual business then gets compromised in the process. So that is the reason that influenced us to change the structure. It applies both to the secondary, it also applies to the apex structure as well. We're saying that the apex structure of a cooperative, which sometimes could be called tertiary, must also be formed by operational secondary cooperatives, so that the whole vertical structure of cooperatives is informed by economic rationality and economic existence, and there are economic needs that are existing on the ground for these things to be created, rather than sometimes they are created only to access government, and then it only benefits those who have created these things, but at the end of the day, they are not sustainable, because once government support is no more there, the whole thing comes down and collapses. At the end of the day. Thank you very much. Then we are going to proceed to the next one, name reservation, which is section 6, page 6 as well, same page. We've not moved there. Here, there were clashes in names, both from the Companies Act as well as cooperatives. We find that the CIPC found that when they were receiving names to register cooperatives, some of these names are already existing as companies, some of these names are already existing as cooperatives. And therefore, they are saying that to ease the administrative burden, cooperatives must first go through the process of reservation of names. Then we check the system both for the company as well as the cooperative, whether that name exists before a cooperative could then be able to be registered. It is a way of protecting already existing names that are there so that they are not violated by any other new name that might appear, and then it could create some problem. And in fact, in some instances, undermine existing brands that are there within the market. That is the rationale that informed that amendment. So we are making it compulsory for cooperatives to reserve names before then. Once three names, the suggested three names, based on those three names, if one does not have any competition, then that one is selected, and then that cooperative takes that particular name because the system has been checked to reserve through the reservation of the names through that process. Name of cooperatives. Then I'll proceed to the next one. This one is Section 10. Section 6, page 6. Yeah, page 6.
Can I just suggest, I think it's got a fine point there. It is page 6, fair enough.
Yes.
Section 6, does it not refer to D? E, actually, E. See, 6, E.
Yeah.
Yes, I want us, because you know that we're going into this act in
yes.
detail, let's
Correct.
Get very specific about where we
okay.
are, it is
All
located.
Right.
It does help us.
It just looks at the E there. The other areas we've already addressed them from your A right up to C. All right. There, here, the reservation of name is only E. Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. And then the next one is the name of cooperative, which is Section 10, page 7. I don't know whether we are all together. Right at the top of page 7, amendment of Section 10 of Act 14 of 2005, right at the top. Yes. Here, what we're saying is that any cooperative, a cooperative must have the word cooperative or co-op as part of its name in respect of the cooperative registered after commencement of the Cooperative Amendment Act 2012. And then, so what the rationale here is this, is that some cooperatives were arguing that if you use the word in its entirety, cooperative, it becomes extensively long. So they were also looking at the shortening of that word, either it is a co-op, so we've afforded that to them, as well as also the limited aspect to say that it is limited in terms of the liabilities of members, so that it doesn't go to their personal assets. So if they take a loan or they are on credit, that loan or credit is limited only to the cooperative itself. It doesn't also cascade to members. And therefore, also there, so it is those particular rights that were enabling them. Also that even the word limited could be abbreviated as LTD, or it could also be the word corporate could also be abbreviated as co-op, co-op. So that is what we were giving there. And also in a way, cooperative may use their names as trademark. That was also the right we were affording them there, because the argument that they made was that some cooperatives, particularly the ones that were established earlier, was that they were using these names in abbreviated form, and they have, now these names become trademarks. So if we are insisting, because the 2005 Act was insisting that first you must put the sector you're coming in the name. So you put the sector, you're saying agricultural cooperative or retail cooperative, consumer cooperative. That's what the 2005 compelled cooperatives to do. and they compel them to put them in full. So others now were saying that they are already having names that are just saying co-op, that are saying LTD, and all of that. So we gave them that particular right, but also that to shorten their name, and then to be able to use this abbreviation as a way of, therefore, protecting their trademark, which are already trademark that they are using there. If you look at also Section 7 there, a corporation may use the trademark name registered to it by the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, followed by the abbreviation Co-op and LTD, if the constitution of the cooperative authorizes the use of such trademark name. So that is the essence of what we were giving the cooperative, that particular act. So that is the amendment that we've made there. So I'll proceed to the next one, constitution of the cooperative in terms of the minimum requirement. That is section 14, page 7. Okay? Right. I think we need to turn to the next page.
I think things are getting a little confusing here.
Yes.
We certainly know it's page 7.
Yes.
And you said section 14.
Yeah, meaning that amendment of section 14.
It's amendment
of section 14. Yeah.
We've really got to get quite specific because, you know, with these, I don't want us to enter into question time yet, but we've got to follow what you are saying.
Amendment of section 14.
Please.
Of
is the slide in line?
Yeah, it is. It is in line. It's just that is the...
All right, just allow me to have a look at it myself now that I've clarified where we are. Just a minute.
We're here. On this one. Yeah. It's just that you didn't move this one. Yeah. But we're here. Yeah. That is. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. We're on this one here. On this section, there was an issue with regard to the enhancement of democratic principles within the cooperative in terms of the minimum requirement that the cooperatives are expected to meet in meeting that test of democracy. So what we then did here, because the previous 2005 Act just only stipulated that the cooperative must have, what you call it, a constitution. And then also they must nominate directors and all that kind of stuff. So, but it didn't specify to the terms of office, it didn't specify. So what you have is that some cooperatives were making submissions that you do have, particularly in APEC structures or secondary cooperatives, whereby you have a tendency where in a one-man dominant cooperative, this person doesn't want to leave as a board or what they will want to be able to rotate their board members and all that kind of stuff as to enhance skills enhancement and also to enhance democratization within the cooperative. So then what we then did was to allow that members must then stipulate in their constitution that a reasonable term of office for directors must be stipulated in the constitution. Whether directors may be reappointed for a conservative term, the manner of rotation of directors must also be stipulated in the constitution. And then the constitution may provide for the appointment of non-executive independent directors within the cooperative. That is that section. It deals with that particular aspect of that. Yes. Can I proceed? Yeah. Okay. I don't want to leave anybody behind. You know. Yeah, page 7 and 8, yeah. Okay. Okay. We are continuing on the same breath, but another clause is within that same section. A constitution of a cooperative must indicate if it is an open cooperative or a closed cooperative. Now, I think a question could be asked, what is meant by open co-op and what is meant by a closed cooperative? Now, whether use transactions with members and non-members of that cooperative, or a cooperative does not conclude transactions with persons who are not members of the cooperative. So a closed co-op is a co-op that transacts with members only. So it's regarded as a closed co-op, as you will see it. It is in our definition under closed co-op there.
A, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, but let's say that too.
Yes.
We must actually point out the clause in this bill.
Yes.
So members can follow.
Yes. That is 14, yeah. It's more like your 14 BBA, all right? Where it is a cooperative that concludes transaction with both members and non-members of that cooperative, or a cooperative that does not conclude transaction with persons who are not members of the co-op. So if it is open, an open co-op is the one that transacts with non-members as well. So it becomes an open cooperative. And then we also say that a provision stipulating the voting rights of each member is... Okay, that one is more on the voting rights. But the next one, which is I, it speaks to the subsection I, the term of office of directors, which we've already addressed. It goes right up down. And then IA...
Just for further clarity,
yes.
Were you not implying, Convict Chair, that the notes, the what do we call it on the board, the slides,
yes.
Shouldn't the slides have all the references?
I mean, this is what I think we're finding.
So that even if we are on our own,
yes,
without the experts,
yes,
we are able to. You know, so even if they are not there, maybe they should insert them as we go on.
Yeah.
Look, I know in other pieces of legislation it has helped us when we referred to the line.
Yes.
There's no misunderstanding if you say line 10 or 12. Now, what line is that on?
Yeah.
The one you are talking about now. What line is it?
It's line, the other one that we've just...
the one we've just been doing.
Yeah, 14.
It's line...
B-A.
Now, give us the line now, so that we all know the line.
It's 5. Line 5.
Yeah, well then line 5 is not 14A. It is amendment section 14, Act 14, and it's now the new 12... which carries on to page 8, which is now line 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Page 8, line 5. Is that right?
Yeah, page 8, line 5.
Right.
Exactly.
Is that all helpful? That's
the
way we're going to go from now on.
Okay.
The page and the line.
Okay.
I don't want any more of this 14, 15s and 8s and that, because there's dozens of them around.
Okay, all right. Okay. It's line 5 that we're talking about. All right. And then on the previous one, we were dealing there with line 15. That is the previous one. The one that is this one here. It was line 15. If I could just go on the line. Okay. Yeah, that is D-I. Yes, that's line 15. Yeah. Then we've dealt with them now, both. All right, then we can proceed to the next one. Associate members. Okay. Page 8, line 40. That's line 40, right at the bottom of page 8, line 40. So that one, it says that the constitution of a cooperative may provide for persons who want to provide support to the cooperative without becoming members of the cooperative to be appointed as associate members. And then there are also related clauses there, which is 45, which is line 45, who may benefit from a cooperative without becoming members of the cooperative to be appointed as associate members. Yeah, these are new insertions. Clarifying associate members, because there was a request from the cooperative that, yes, indeed, they could have associate members, but we must clarify who are the associate members and what rights do they enjoy within the cooperative, what particular power or rights do they enjoy. So this bill now clarifies absolutely clear. All right. And then it also says that associate members, a membership is a temporary membership which is valid for a period of 12 months. After the period of 12 months, associate members, subject to the approval by the members of the cooperative, have the choice to become full member of a cooperative or may have their associate membership renewed. All right. And then cooperatives that have associate members must indicate in their financial reporting system the full members of the cooperative and associate members, so that now we know who are the associate members and who are the actual members within the cooperative. Because you don't want to have a situation whereby associate members now have votes, they have rights which they should not enjoy, but they should be delineated from the real members of a cooperative. And then the last clause there, which is 55, associate members do not have any voting rights. So those are the rights they don't enjoy and the rights they enjoy. Yes, we have amended that. Yes. Okay, then we can go to the next one, categorization of primary cooperatives. Page 9, 5 to 15. All right. Okay. Here we are clarifying categories of primary cooperative. The minister must prescribe the monetary threshold for the annual revenue or projected annual revenue for each of the following categories of primary cooperative. A, category A primary cooperative, which is a small primary cooperative. A, category B primary cooperative, which is a small to medium primary cooperative. And a category C primary cooperative, which is a medium to large cooperative. Category A, B, and C primary cooperative are primary cooperatives that are excluded from deposit-taking financial services cooperative and the cooperative bank. So what we're saying here is that we are giving categorization. The question could be, why are we doing that? Just to give a background, the reason for this is that we want to be able to target the support on cooperatives. There are cooperatives that are big. We have categorized them as primary C, medium to large. So the different support we give to them. Cooperatives that are A, small cooperatives, and small to medium cooperatives, we then focus on them, we know, we delineate them very clearly, and then we provide support. But also, in compliance aspect, they have to comply differently. Like in the issue of audit, as you will see, cooperatives that are big, we want them to be audited, including secondary cooperatives as well as the apex bodies. But the others, we want them to get independent review reports, and the others accounting reports, which can just be provided by the directors, so that we ease the burden on compliance to submit to the CIPC on this requirement. So that is the issue there. That's why the delineation, that's why it informs that kind of targeted support and then also a targeted compliance requirement to ease the burden and taking advantage of the levels with which the cooperatives are at in terms of their development. We are proceeding to the next area, which is liability of members not holding shares in the cooperative. This one is amendment of section 23, which is in page 10, and it's line 30, yeah? Line 30. All right. Section 23 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the addition of the following subsection, the existing section becoming subsection 1 and 2. In instances where members do not hold shares, members are only liable for the amount of money owed to the cooperative in terms of the membership agreement. It says that simply. Because there are different formulations. Some cooperatives could have membership shares, others do want to have their members having fees, and then also we're saying that in a case where they do not hold shares, they're using fees, members will be liable to those fees where that cooperative is prescribing the fees, all right, in terms of the liabilities that they will be required to comply with within the cooperative, unless they've taken a loan from the cooperative. This doesn't address that. If they've taken a loan, they're liable to pay that loan because they are owing within the cooperative, if the cooperative is giving them the loan. But in terms of just membership and also to be part of the co-op, they're only liable to that fee which was expressed in the membership agreement, if they're using fee, because they could use any particular form. All right. We are proceeding there. The next one is annual submissions. Page 11, number 5 to 15. Right. The minister must, by notice in the gazette, determine the form, manner, and time period for the annual submission of information to the CIPC regarding the membership of the cooperative, members of the cooperative, and nature and value of the contribution made by each member to the cooperative and the annual fees payable to the CIPC by cooperative based on the categories of cooperative. So here is the compliance issue. We're saying cooperative must submit their must have the submission which they do to the of information to the CIPC. They are expected to comply. Give us what is the members that are existing within the cooperative. Because members change from one year to another, there might be growth of membership, so we want to see that growth of membership. And there might also be members of cooperative, the actual name. Because sometimes a conflict arises where certain members are saying that I'm a member of the cooperative but I'm not recognized. We want that to be known within the CIPC so that they submit those members and keep the records in their own corporate, but some of that members must also be forwarded to CIPC so that if conflict arises, these things could be sorted out. And the nature and value of contribution made by each member, so that when at a later stage, and that day, the previous law, a member says is liable only to those fees we need to know, what are those fees? And all of that kind of stuff, and the contribution that the members have made in that particular regard, and if they've made fees, which are the fees of about 100 grand, the fee per member, so that must be submitted, so that that information is known. So that in case of dispute, these matters could be easily resolved because there are records that are there. And then also, there is this annual fee payable by CIPC to the CIPC based on the categories of cooperatives. Here, there are issues here where CIPC has argued that they've adopted the model of being a commission, Madam Speaker. Chair. Yes, apology. In the language of Parliament, maybe I'm not yet accustomed to you. I think I'm getting. Apologies. The issue here is this. The CIPC is now a commission. Now, as a commission, the implication is that it must raise its funds through registration, through all of its operations. Now, this is having an impact on the cooperative, the registration arm of cooperatives within the CIPC. At the moment, financially, it is unsustainable. Given the fact that cooperatives, their registration is very 200 and something, it's very less, which then means that administratively, CIPC is unable to sustain itself financially. So therefore, the CIPC made a submission to us that they would like to compensate that lack of finance by requesting cooperatives based on their categories in terms of their scales of strength to contribute annual fees to them to be able to beef up the administrative costs and ensure that it is a bit, it achieves sustainability. That's then the reason behind these annual fees that have been requested to corporate.
Okay.
That's the essence of it. Chair. Right. Now we're going to the next one, which is the Supervisory Committee. Page 11, 20 to 9, 20 to 35. Now, here we're clarifying the Supervisory Committee. We're saying that the Supervisory Committee must be elected at the meeting contemplated in Section 32, Subsection 3, when the Board of Directors are elected. So this Section 32, Subsection 3, is the annual general meeting. So meaning that in the annual general meetings of the cooperative, the Supervisory Committee must also be elected. And it must consist of members who are not directors in the board or also not directors in managing the cooperative and who are also not board members. May be established for every cooperative if the constitution of the cooperative concern provides for such a committee. The Supervisory Committee is responsible for supervising the Board of Directors by representing the interest of its members. Must, if there is fair and reasonable information that any act or omission by the Board of Directors may impact negatively on the cooperative or a member or members thereof, call a special meeting of all its members to discuss such act or omission. Must within 7 days after a special meeting contemplated in paragraph 3 in writing inform the tribunal of the outcome of such meeting, and board of directors and the members or members affected or concerned of its decision and reasons for the decision. If the supervisory committee has not complied with subsection 5C, a member of the cooperative may report the matter to the tribunal. So the supervisory committee is a structure that is to deal with where, in some instances, if I could just give it as an example, you have a situation where a consumer cooperative is created like Macro, before Macro converted into a company, where there are thousands and thousands of members. But through the operations of that cooperative over time, there is convergence between board members and directors to the level that it therefore harms the interest of the members generally. And in that situation, you might find that even if you speak in that scale, you find that not all members will come into annual general meetings and all that kind of stuff. So these are the kinds of shortcomings. And these are things that also came out even in Europe, in some of the European countries where you have these big cooperatives that are in that scale. And therefore, a supervisory committee is just to be a safeguard against that collusion that might take place between the board, which must oversee the managers, which are directors, and the directors, because these things do happen in practice. So the supervisory committee could be a safeguard structure that can be able to oversee those kinds of situations not operating. So it is in that regard, but we've made it optional because some cooperatives are small in such a way that you don't need the membership, just 5 or 4 or 6, and they have about 5 or 10 or 15. It's easy that to be rectified because it's the same members. So some cooperatives may not have the supervisory committee, but the ones that, because of the enormity and the scale, might require it, then they can then put it in their constitution.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, sir, could you just tell me which section are you dealing with? The only reference I took is...
Amendment of Section 27.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to give us this right now. Yes.
Amendment of Section 27, Act 14 of 2005, page 11, it's line 20 to 35. Is it clear? It's line 20 to
35. Which page?
Page 11. Page 11.
Okay.
Page 11. Just there in the middle of page 11, mm-hmm. You've got line 20 to 35. Line 20 to
35. Thank you.
Yeah.
Ask you, Chief Director, if it will be possible to, on a fresh set of slides, members are going to be dealing with this index for a long time.
Yes.
Just put the page and the line number on each slide,
please,
and send them back again, because we can't work like this. And it's a piece of legislation that we're working with.
And then, so those are the ones on supervisory committee, and then I will proceed to the next one, which is progress.
Page 11.
Page 11. Line 40 to 50. Section 38 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the addition of the following subsections, subsection 3 here. If provided for in the constitution of the cooperative, a member of a cooperative may at any time appoint another member of the cooperative as a proxy to participate in and vote at a general or special meeting on behalf of the member concerned, provided that the member may not appoint more than one proxy to exercise voting, right? A proxy appointment must be in writing, dated, signed by the member, and remain valid for the period explicitly set out in the appointment unless it is revoked by the member concerned. The number of proxies that a member may carry on behalf of another member or other member, as contemplated in subsection 3, may not exceed 5% of the total membership of the cooperative. So we've put clear safeguards so that this proxy right is not abused, so that there are limitations built into it. So what we're saying is that a proxy could only just be appointed for a short period of time specified in that note, as well as also it must not be constitute 5% more than 5% of the total membership of the cooperative, so that there should be no at any time when this matter is abused. But there are circumstances whereby members cannot make up into the meeting, then they could send proxies to be able to vote on their behalf and be able to cover them in those matters where they trust those proxies. All right.
Next, Chair, could I just have a question? I've now found the original act which you're referring to.
Yeah.
And that says that you can have telephonic, electronic, or other communications. Will the proxy apply to that as well?
We haven't yet started the questions. At the moment, we're just going through this and getting our places. Then, as soon as this is finished, we will, in fact, interrogate the situation. Can we move on that point, please?
Fine, madam.
Thank you.
The next one is governance of cooperatives. Page 12. Line 20 to 35. Section 32 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsection 3 of the following subsection. The Board of Directors must be elected for such a period as set out in the Constitution of the Cooperative. All other issues relating to the Board of Directors which are not provided for in this Act must be provided for in the constitution of the cooperative. The members of a cooperative may, by resolution of 2/3 of the members present at the special meeting convened by the supervisory committee, or called by at least 25% of members when such cooperative does not have a supervisory committee, dissolve the board of directors if such members find justifiably good reason that the board is dysfunctional or has acted contrary to any law. So those are the allowable clauses there under governance of cooperatives. flexible auditing regime, which is page 14. Line 5 to 15. In fact, line 5 to 15. The following cooperative must produce an auditor's annual accounting report to the registrar in respect of each financial year. Category C, primary cooperative, are expected to submit a audit report. Secondary cooperative, cooperative apex organization. Category B, primary co, must produce an independent reviewer's annual accounting report to the registrar in respect of each financial year. Category A, primary co, must produce an annual accounting report to the registrar in respect of each financial year signed by the directors of the cooperative. The minister must, within 3 months of the commencement of this act, by notice, publish a cooperative reporting system framework. So those are the clauses that relate to compliance with auditing and the independent review, as well as the annual accounting report. And then it also categorizes cooperatives, which cooperatives, primary cooperatives, and cooperatives in general that must comply with which report. Then we are going to the next one is accounting practices. Page 17, line 35. Okay. The repeal of Section 55 of Act 14 of 2005. Section 55 of the Principal Act is hereby repealed. Amendments of Section 56 of Act. Yeah. So we have repealed that section in its entirety. Yes. Yeah. It's just line 35. Yes. And then we go to the next one. Area amended, amalgamate, divide and convert or transfer. It's page. Page 18, line 5 to 30. Amendment of Section 62 of Act 14 of 2005. Section 62 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution in subsection 1 for paragraph A of the following paragraph. A, convert into any other form of cooperative into a company contemplated in the Companies Act 2008. Act number 71 of 2008, or into any form of corporate or unincorporated body other than a cooperative or a company in accordance with the applicable legislation. Yeah. Yes. So those, that it deals with that aspect. And then it continues on convent, isn't it? Yeah. Register the newly converted cooperative, which is line 25, by the substitution in subsection 7 for paragraph C of the following 25 of the following paragraph. C, if the corporate is converted into a company, all members of the corporate become shareholders of that company, and it cannot continue to use the word cooperative in its name or branding. Covers the next slide. And then the next one is winding up and judicial management. Page 20, line 5 to 10.
If I could just ask a clarification.
Honorable Hill Lewis?
We're skipping sometimes through several pages. I presume we're just dealing with the most important amendments.
Yes.
Just the most important amendments, because even the sections we're skipping contain amendments.
Yeah, we're dealing with the most important, because some of the other issues you will see as you read are more subsections of the same content, which is more now in depth. We could go to them in detail, but like the one on divide and amalgamate, it's got other elements there. So we're just picking up the core of that particular section. All right. Modes of winding up. A cooperative may be wound up voluntarily in terms of section 1A by an order of the court in terms of section 72, by an order of the registrar or tribunal in terms of section 72B. The minister must, by notice in the Gazette, prescribe procedures relating to the modes of winding up within 3 months of commencement of this act. So what we're saying is that there is modes in detail are going to be articulated in the regulations as to how are the procedures of to wind up. Those procedures are going to be issued out by the minister. There is what you call it voluntary wind up, which is in session of section 71A in Act 14 of 2005. A cooperative may by wind up voluntarily by special resolution of a minimum of 60% of its full members. Those are the ones that are there. And then you've got the wind-up by the order of registrar of tribunal, and all of those, they go right up to the line 40. These are the different modes of winding up, which we have. And then there's other one, application for declaratory order, which is a court winding up by the court. Okay. And then now the other one is judicial management, which is page 21, 9, 10, up to 20. Judicial management. Judicial management, in any matter relating to the functioning of a cooperative, identified by the tribunal as having the potential to result in an order of provisional judicial management being issued in respect of such corporate, the tribunal must provide every form of support that is within its mandate, as set out in Chapter 12C, to the cooperative concern. In the event of the tribunal not being able to transform the cooperative concern into an operational cooperative, the provisions relating to judicial management will apply. The minister must, by notice in the Gazette, publish procedures relating to judicial management within 3 months of commencement of this act. Okay. All right, we've dealt with that part. Okay. And then, we've dealt also with the winding up, which is about, we're dealing now with the advisory board, with the which is page 22, line 20 to 45. Chapter 12 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for the expression advisory board, wherever it appears, of the expression advisory council. Amendment of section 86 of Act 14 of 2000. Section 86 of the is hereby amended by the substitution for the heading of the following head. Functions of Advisory Council. Now, the function of the Advisory Council are to advise the Minister generally and to make recommendations with regard to the provisions of support programs that target cooperatives as determined by the Minister by notice in the Gazette, and promote equity and greater participation by the members of the cooperative, by the deletion of paragraph E, by the substitution of paragraph F of the following paragraph, any matter referred to the advisory council by the minister, the agency, a cooperative, proposed cooperative, or member of a cooperative that relates to any matter pertaining to cooperatives, including but not limited to the promotion of the development of cooperatives. Yeah. And then also it goes down to Section 87 as well, which is 50 to 55. Members of Advisory Council. The Minister must appoint as members of the Advisory Council not less than 5, but not more than 10 persons appropriately qualified to represent the interests of cooperatives in the Republic, by the substitution in subsection 2 for the words preceding paragraph A of the following words. When appointing members in terms of subsection 1, the minister must have regard to the need for the advisory council to represent different relevant constituencies, including trade unions, business, cooperative support organizations, women, youth, the disabled, and academics. The minister must designate one of the members of the advisory council as chairperson. I think that concludes the clause on the advisory, the clauses on advisory board. And then we are going to the other area, cooperative development agency. It's the same page which follows the this one, which is line 20.
Page 23, which is line 20 to 25.
All right. The Cooperative Development Agency is hereby established. The agency must exercise its powers and perform its functions in accordance with this Act and any other relevant law. After consultation with the relevant authorities, the agency may establish satellite branches in every province, metropolitan, municipality, and district in accordance with this chapter. And then what follows then on 991B are the objectives of the agency, as well as the functions of the agency, the general powers and reporting by the agency, as well as the funding of the agency. And then that whole, those are the details that follows right up to page 26. Tribunal, establishment, legal status, and composition of the cooperative tribunal. Yeah, it's page 26, line 40-45. The cooperative tribunal is hereby established and has jurisdiction throughout the Republic, is independent and subject to the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996. The Promotion of Administrative Justice Act 2000. This act and other applicable legislation must assist with the judicial management, winding up, deregistration, conflict resolution, liquidation, and conducting of investigations to ensure compliance with this act, and must perform its function impartially without fear, favor, or prejudice. And then you've got also the appointment of the and composition of tribunal, functions of the tribunal, prohibition on tribunal, adjudication of hearings before tribunal, right to participate in hearings, powers of tribunal in adjudicating hearings, rules of procedures, and then the conflict resolution commission that drives the tribunal, all the areas of power and enter and search, all of these are details that regards to the tribunal. They run right up to page.
Mention that then what we've got is on page 27, the function, line 15, page 28, the prohibition of the tribunal about 21 or 2.
Right up to 34,
You remember, you are familiar with this act, members of.
I am. Right up to page 34. Yeah, it's 34. Right up to page 34, which is line 5, And then now the next issues that we are dealing with here will be in relation to the worker corp. Okay.
Line.
No, it's now page 36.
Yeah,
I'm
on
page 34.
Yeah, it ends in page 34, line 5. Yeah.
Now we're getting to page 36.
Line 5, page 34, that's where the tribunal ends, and then we've got other issues there that follows after that.
Page 36,
we're dealing here with the worker corp. You will recall, Chairperson, page 36, line 15 to line 30, all right, application of labor legislation, okay. You will recall, Chairperson, that I raised the issue of NERSEC, of the worker corp. This law deals with that issue of a worker corp, whereby in the 2005 Act, the worker cooperative were exempted from the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the Labor Relations Act. So the new formulation says, application of labor legislation, an employee of a worker cooperative is defined as a member or a non-member who receives a wage or who receives any form of income from the cooperative. An employee of a worker corp is deemed to be an employee as defined in the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. All worker cooperatives must comply with applicable labor legislation. Despite subsection 1 and 2, a cooperative may apply for an exemption from the bargaining council consent, or if the cooperative falls outside the scope of the bargaining council, for a variation from the Minister of Labor in respect of members who are employees, in cases where compliance will create legal anomalies, or in cases where the only employees involved are members who do not receive a wage and where the cooperative does not supply more than half its product to a company registered for value-added tax. So in a sense here, what we're saying is that worker cooperative must comply with these acts, and therefore they can only be exempted if they make the application to the bargaining council or the Minister of Labor if they want to be exempted from these two legislations. There is a case to be made for the small cooperative to ask for that exemption because they are weak. Some of these labor laws might have very burdensome to them in terms of complying with them because they deal with matters of health, what, and all the issues that you have to put them there. So they might ask for some of the onerous aspects of the labor legislation for this exemption. So the clauses give them that leeway. So the next issue then is housing cooperatives. There we're going backwards in a sense, which is page 35, line 45 to 50. Page 35, line 45 to 50. The following item is hereby substituted for item C of part 1 of the Schedule 1 to the Principal Act, application of other legislation. The provisions of the Share Blocks Control Act do not apply to a housing cooperative registered in terms of this act in respect of every individual unit owned by the cooperative concerned that is used by a member by means of a rental agreement. And it then goes to page 36, if you allow me, Chair. Applied to a housing cooperative that in terms of this act in respect of every individual unit of the housing cooperative concerned that has been transferred in ownership to a member. The provisions of the Sectional Titles Act apply to any unit owned by the housing cooperative or transferred ownership to a member if the provisions of the Sectional Titles Act have been complied with. So those are the clauses that really covers the housing cooperative. The next one are the social cooperative, which is page 37, line 40. Social cooperative. This part applies to social cooperatives which must comply with the requirement contemplated in this part. All other relevant provisions of this act. The name of a social cooperative must comply with the requirements of Section 10 of this Act. A requirement, in addition to any other requirement of this Act, the constitution of a social cooperative must specify the nature of the social services the cooperative aims to provide its members. Surplus. A social cooperative may set aside 100% of its surplus to an indivisible reserve and capitalize all donations and grants in order to enjoy the benefits of public benefit organization, termination of membership, despite any other provision of this, the constitution of a social cooperative may give the board of directors of the social the power to terminate the membership of a member if there is good reason to do so. Before terminating the membership of a member, the board of directors must give such member notice that termination is contemplated, written reasons for the proposed termination, which, in case of a member who has served a period of probation, must relate to the conduct or capacity of the member to carry out his or her duties or to the operational requirements of the cooperative and a right to be heard. A member whose membership is terminated by the board of directors has a right to appeal to a general meeting within the time limit set out in the constitution. A termination of the membership of a member by the board of directors is confirmed on appeal if the members at a duly called general meeting do not reverse the decision of the board of directors. If a general meeting is called to consider the appeal of a member whose membership is terminated and a quorum of members is not present, the decision of the board of directors cannot be confirmed. So those are the requirements for the social cooperative. The last one is the definition. For the purpose of this part, social cooperative means the cooperative whose main objective is to provide social services to its members, such as the elderly, children, and the sick. Thank you, Chairperson. I think that concludes the presentation. We have covered all the core issues of the bill.
Thank you very much, Chief Director and what we're going to do, members, this has been quite difficult for us to follow, and I do want to discuss this with DTI. So if we can take our tea break now for 10 minutes or so, that would be very helpful. It's just after 10:45. If we can be back here just before 11 o'clock. Is that all right? Fine. Thank you. No. Honourable James, if I could have a quick word with you as well, just before I speak, we're going to adopt. And if members can listen, because this would be quite important for new members, I think, to the committee. What we're going to do, and this is for the department, we are going to get a new set of slides, only with the additions of the references, which will help all of us. So don't, when you get the new set of slides, say, oh, well, I don't know where I am now, the information. The information won't change, the substantive. Only the reference, per se. You'll get that in addition. Now, that's for members. Secondly, for the department now, what we want after today's session, we're going to start clause by clause by clause. We're not racing through to what's core and what isn't core. Now it's still part of the broader overview. But the very next meeting, it's going to be clause by clause. That is what it's going to be. You're going to have to work with the subcommittee chaired by Honourable Mabasa and go into depth there. So I hope the department is very clear on that one. Where the committee is concerned, we do need, in the absence of the COPE last week, we've got to have a member from the DA. We need a firm member from the DA, Honourable James, who will sit on co-ops. We need one from COPE. Now, the person I thought was sitting on co-ops from last week, I think it was Honourable James, was the Honourable Hill Lewis, but I'm not sure. So if we can get that confirmation right now. The DA, it will be?
Honorable Gil Lewis.
Certainly had his holiday. And then Cope?
Madam, I'll have to speak to the alternate and to our whip first, and then I'll come back to you. But we'll certainly do our bit.
Meeting will be next week, I think. That's what's worrying me. All right. And then we have the IFP, Honorable Ariane Ambrosini.
Madam, I think that on this one you can do without my spiritual input. I trust you enough. There's lots of cleaning up that this bill requires in terms of the draft is very poorly. But I trust that the parliamentary law advisors can do that. I'll send you a set of amendments at the technical level.
Well, what may be quite constructive, seeing as you're looking at a series of amendments, and you know we mean this, and in the past you have popped into subcommittees. You know, you have one in, right. Now, I think it could be constructive for you to go and make some representations to the subcommittee in the first instance, so at least they get an appreciation. And then when we come back, that'll certainly, because you're not officially sitting there as a full member, you can certainly speak to it in the main committee. Do we agree on that point? Right. From the ANC side, we said the Honourable Mabaso, and we also said the Honourable Salah. Of course, I am a little worried with him being medically unfit for duty, but we will follow that up. So that part is cleared. Now, members, just another little point before we go to the questions. The NCC, which had been requested to meet with us last week, had indicated they had a meeting with the Auditor General at the same time, so quite rightly, we thought that should go ahead. And we indicated in written correspondence that we would invite her at another time when the labelling issue came back again, as we know it will come. We had a request to meet yesterday to meet with us today. But I know members are like me, we just don't want to chop and change our agendas on major issues all the time. So I did respond to her request. And that is the Commissioner Moshlala indicating that in the next quarter we will be inviting her back as indicated. So I think that should suffice, members. And we are going to share with all members the information the Commissioner gave us in response to about 6 weeks ago. You will remember when we were trying to tie up the budgetary issues. But I will just get this distributed through the committee secretary to everyone. So we can pass on that and just go straight on by show of hands to pertinent questions that have come up from this briefing. The Honourable Ariane Ambrosini. Yes, Honourable Elvis, Honourable Kwabasa, Honourable Mabasa. Will that be it for the moment? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just two quick questions, if I may. First of all, I'm sort of puzzled as to how and why a bill with the other tabled in... Let me take this from a different viewpoint. There has been justification for the amendments. I've read the amendments and we'll discuss them, and they're quite self-explanatory, but what is not explanatory is the measure of the justification. It gives me a sense at times that we are trying to draw the baby out with the bathwater and trying to make inquiries on how dirty the bathwater really is. Let me give you an example, if I may, to you, Madam Chairman. The issue of the abuse in respect of labor relations and people working in conditions which do not comply with the labor laws. Now, the purpose of cooperatives was exactly that of having a bunch of people coming together, working their bones off, a new business. Now we are taking this benefit out, which is one of the key elements of the cooperative spirit, is the association thing, and we are making the cooperative, the employer, no matter what type of benefits there is, becomes the employer and everything needs to follow under the Labor Relations Act. How much of an abuse has there been? I mean, are we reacting to one case, another case? Is there any way of quantifying that? The same thing about the entire amendment on cooperatives being productive. I mean, especially and the fact that we would no longer allow to have a second tier cooperative established until they are the first tier cooperatives established. I mean, one of the purposes originally of having these second tier cooperatives was to create a marketplace to enable the first tier cooperative to be established. So a bunch of guys come together and establish a marketing entity that enables people to get on the production side. So it would make sense at the business level to have the marketing entity before there is the production side. If somebody is willing to take the risk. And I accept people will abuse it because as soon as there is a subsidy, everything gets twisted and thwarted. The market forces don't operate anymore. And they, as you indicated, they go for the grant and they set up something for which there is no need to. But again, how much abuse there has been and in respect, because we're doing away with the entire youth. Then this was the first question. The second question on the financial implications. I mean, I would like to have a feeling. The memorandum says that there will be financial implications, but there isn't a cost. We are looking at establishing what, at least on paper, seems to be a new and quite considerable bureaucracy, tribunal and agency and etc. And I'm not sure whether you can fund the agency the way you're suggesting to be funded, but if that can be done, what is the actual cost of this bill? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Right. Can we please have the Honourable Elders, followed by the Honourable Kubasa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that there's a RIA report that was published February 2012. I was wondering whether we could have a copy of that, and perhaps if the DCR can give us just a brief overview of what the report says. Then, I'm not an expert on cooperatives, but having regard to the Companies Act that we've gone through last year and the various innovative changes regarding transparency and the responsibilities of directors, whether that has been considered as well, especially with regard to the fiduciary duties that directors have, and whether that had any impact on the amendments that we see today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Kubasa.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first question I would like to pose is what prompted the amendment of this bill? Is it a particular direction that you want the cooperative as compared to what has happened in the past, or you had a look at the existing cooperatives, found challenges with them, and that would have informed, therefore, your thinking on amending the bill. Or is it a combination of both? The second question, I would like to understand to have a very clear understanding of the worker cooperative. Are we talking about workers who would have been retrenched and because of the skill and experience you put them together to then become a cooperative different are they going to be from the company they are working for? So I would like to hear about that. The last one, Chairperson, is page 13, the first slide, the top slide. You are talking about the repeal of auditing exemption and provision and so on and so on and so on. Would that repeal of auditing exemption arise from the fact that the cooperative would have grown and would have graduated to a higher category? What would inform that repeal of exemption? Thank you.
Honorable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Committee Chair. Thanks for the input made by the Chief Director and the Deputy Director. On page 11, I have two questions there on the amendment bill. Where on line 15, on page 11, under that's clause 23, the sources of funding for the CIPC, are we sure that we want the cooperatives to be another source of funding? You know, I'm just looking at the other way is we may find that strangles the very, you know, that it frustrates the very intention that we seek to achieve, because it's like making cooperatives to compete with companies. And then at the bottom, where we talk about the proxy, that's line 45, line 50, that area. Is there no danger that we may find cooperatives disarming themselves in terms of growing up by looking for experts to represent them, you know, calling them proxy, but where you find it's like where government offers services, and like in the CIPC, the very CIPC, where you find there are people outside who are readily available to assist people to fill forms, and then they charge those people, which goes against the intention of government. So that I think the proxy may there is some abusive potential element. And then on page 18, I just want to check whether colleague Gwabaza has not covered me, but oh yes, no. Where the conversion of cooperatives into companies, what is the international experience? Should we, is it that it's a common practice, or do cooperatives tend to stay cooperatives? Then the last one is on page 30, page 36, 37. Where we talk of exemption, that's clause 73, 15 to 30. That exemption, shouldn't the act be such that it already contains exemption by design? Because if we say the very cooperatives that are still growing up, they now have to apply for exemption, they may not even be having the capacity to do that. And that will even be before they start to function. So thanks, Colette Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chair.
I've got three questions. The idea of the supervisory committees, they're to supervise the boards. to my knowledge, quite unprecedented kind of setup. And it brings with it some inherent dangers. I just want to understand more clearly the powers, the intended powers of the supervisory committees, because we don't want to set up just another board. So are they there only to call special meetings if they have concerns? What exactly are the intended powers? Then with regard to the proxy vote limitations, also there are some hidden dangers. If for example, you have a 10 members, even one proxy then would exceed the 5% limit that you've laid down. What's the point of the 5% limit? And then the auditing requirements. I think you've put in there that all, even A, B, or C cooperatives must be audited. That's quite burdensome, especially for the first category, the small and survivalist co-ops. The costs related to auditing are prohibitive for small businesses and entrepreneurs. I can imagine they would be even more prohibitive for survivalist cooperatives. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Comments? No. Let's wait because we're coming for another round, Honourable Mabasa. Yes. Could we please turn to DTI now for a response?
Chair, let me start with audit, because that's what is easy to deal with. If you look at the law that deals with the audit requirement, it gives three categories. The first category is audit. The second category is independent review, report. The third category is accounting report. The accounting report is going to be a pager, and the cooperatives that are expected to comply with the accounting report is the managers or directors within the cooperative must just sign that accounting report and send it to the CIPC, is a pager, where what have they done with the resources of the cooperative. So that what we want to eliminate is a culture whereby managers sometimes do not account. We want them to start accounting and submitting these reports. It will not be audited by anybody. It will be managers taking an oath and signing the signatures that it is a true reflection of what transpired in the survivalist category of primary cooperative and the small one, and then they submit that accounting report. So there will be no auditing there. The independent review is from medium to small to medium. We think those must do an independent review. An independent review, it is a report that will put together by an accounting officer. And that accounting officer either is employed within the cooperative as an accounting officer or a bookkeeper, who will then fill up that particular report and send it to the CIPC with the approval of the board as well as also the manager of the cooperative forward. It therefore covers those small to medium cooperatives. Large cooperatives that are bigger and secondary cooperative and APEC, those are the ones that we're saying they must be audited, because auditing for them is something that they will acquire. So what will they will be able to afford? What will then happen in the regulation, we will then put actual values and revenues that clearly categorizes what is a micro to small cooperative, small to medium, and medium to large. And then there are those revenue values that are going to clearly in the regulation now stipulate who are these that are going to be able to comply. You will see that it will be those that whose values are high there, the auditing for them, it is going to be acceptable. So in that regard, we've factored very clearly that burden so that we remove it, but at the same time, we want to be able to bring cooperatives to submit their report. Why we are doing it, particularly for the ones which are your media, small to micro or survival. The bulk of these cooperatives receive government funding in the form of grants.
And therefore, we want them to demonstrate in their own accounting report what have they done with this money so that CIPC can receive it. So that also the practice of just accounting and that knowing that there will be no free lunch, that you're going to just get this money and then you're not accountable to anybody, and then what you do, some of them, what they then do, they start selling these assets, knowing that they are not going to be able to account. We want to stop and say, you will, at some measure or some form, account for that particular resources that you've received, even the one that. And then also we build a culture of accountability anyway, and also transparency on their conduct and their behavior. Because that it goes also to the question that was raised on what are the built-in mechanisms to bring about transparency of managers to submit these annual reports, so that they cover all their conduct and the manner in which they have now dealt with their cooperative, and then that becomes transparent and it becomes public information that is submitted to the CIPC. On the proxy, now, proxy are going to be first. Proxy, a non-member who is not part of the cooperative cannot be a proxy. Proxies are going to be members of the cooperative. So within the membership, you've got those members that are not going to be able to attend the annual general meeting or special meetings for whatever reasons. Because sometimes some of the meetings come to the point where not all members could be there. Then the members can then give rights of proxy to other members to be able to represent them in meetings, so that at the end of the day they are able to ensure that certain decisions. So it means that even if they go to the meeting, the law requires those who are calling the meeting to set up the agenda, to provide documents up front for these meetings, so that by the time members going there, they know exactly what are the issues that are going to be discussed, and then they give voting powers to members to take certain particular positions as proxies there into those meetings. So in that regard, first, there will be no experts who are outside the cooperative who will have the right to proxy. Secondly, proxy will only be the members. And then thirdly, we're saying within that membership, in its totality, 100%, you cannot have a situation whereby 5% or more are proxies. What that does, it renders the entire meeting run by proxies. You see, we want to limit the meeting not to be only meetings of proxies, so that you have a situation whereby this thing can scale up to 50 to 100. But it can only be limited in terms of the totality of membership to 5, so that that allows people to be able to address the notion whereby you've got proxies now becoming the only ones who are making decisions on critical matters of the cooperative. That's why we've provided that limitation. On the auditing exemption, I think we've addressed the issue there of the exemption on the worker co-op. Let me add it this way. The 2005 Cooperative Act exempted worker co-ops. It says, you are a worker co-op. Before maybe I started being a worker, let me just explain what is a worker co-op, because there was a question that was asked on what is a worker co-op, so that we can understand all of us. A worker co-op is a cooperative that is formed voluntarily by members to be able to utilize expertise and the labor power available to them to meet their economic needs, their social needs, or their needs in production. Primarily, most of the worker cooperatives are in production or in services to some extent, but these are people with certain expertise or certain labor power. They're using that labor power that they have to be able to meet their economic needs. It could be, in other scenarios, workers who are working in a particular factory, they gain the experience to manufacture certain goods, they come together, they create a worker co-op to produce that kind of the production that they've got the expertise over the years. They've been working and doing these things, doing welding of particular parts and all that, and then they create a worker cooperative in that regard. So it's more around labor. Now there are two forms of worker cooperative that could be established. There is a worker cooperative whereby workers are using their labor power to produce for themselves, and they are both owners of the means of production, but they are also the users, or they sell that means of production and they get the gain. But there is other worker cooperatives who are just purely selling their labor.
They are not producing anything. They are going around to already existing entities and saying, here is our expertise, here is our labor. We want somebody to hire this labor. They are collectively as workers. So there are two forms of the worker co-op. They are then selling their labor to everybody who is existing in the company, or they use their labor as when they own those means of production and they're producing. So there are two forms of worker cooperative that could be established. Even on both those, they could then also, within the worker co-op, because they've got ownership and worker in it, there are those, particularly in production, who could then say, we are owners as well as also workers, but we want to have another additional labor, which is not going to enjoy ownership. But we want it either for temporal basis to be able to access because we've got bigger orders to... So in that way you've got, within the worker co-op, two now types of workers there. Who are the ones which have worker and owner, and the others who are just employees. So within the worker co-op, there will be those two categories. And therefore, what then we're saying is that the Act says you could have pure employees to a limit of 40. Could not pass 40 where it's worker owned. It has the 2005, we didn't amend that law to a limit of 40 to then have pure employees, but you must retain the worker co-op component, which has an ownership dimension in it. Now, what then happened in the market, the quantity? The challenge here was companies who had to meet basic conditions of employment and labor relations act realized here is an opportunity, all right, in KZN. Most of the textile industries in KZN, they did that. We've got the data that was submitted by all the labor unions that were involved in, which was submitted by a network. There is a data which we could make it available to this committee. Most of these companies, advised by expert lawyers, looked at the cooperative and then said, listen, you can get around these basic conditions of employment and labor relations act by converting your employees within a factory floor into worker co-ops. Therefore, in that regard, they become worker co-ops who are selling their labor to you. And then in that particular respect, they are then, you are not required to comply with these two leases because now you've got these employees exempted from these two leases. Therefore, your argument in the bargaining council will be to say, listen, these are worker co-ops who are selling their labor to us, therefore they should not comply. The implications of that has been that the law has been now undermined. And that, now from the labor side, now by labor I mean union, consultant, and the rest, could see this as an issue that is another mechanism which is to create a two-tier labor market in the economy. All right? Which then whittles down the rights of workers using the worker cooperative. And therefore, that's the reason why this particular clause was to be able to stop that particular drilling down of that particular practices to deny them all the rights. The rights that are accrued to all employees are then now going out of the window, pension funds. All the benefits that goes with all of these kinds of things when you're an employee are no more there because you're within the worker cooperative.
I just want to remind you, Mr. Nduma, you've only got 7 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Let me proceed. So, yes, I just wanted, because this question had a number of engagements in different directions, I want you to address all those directions. Thanks. Let me then proceed. What prompted the amendment in reality? Okay. The amendment initially, when it started, it never started as an approach where we say we want to use the law to take a particular direction. Initially, it was the request from the market saying that your 2005 Act created certain requirements that are undermining us in the market to be able to comply with it. Therefore, we want you to relook at the law in the regulation itself. And then the second input was the one on the worker. But as we were engaging with the process, we then decided as the department the following, that we're going to use this particular law to address also other issues of development, challenges we're facing around the cooperative, in a sense that it is riddled by high levels of conflict. We need to have a mechanism to deal with conflict, in a sense that there are aspects within the cooperative to the aspect within the cooperatives where you've got non-compliance with the law, and we don't have tools to go and enforce the law in a sense of going out and investigate these non-compliance in the market. So we said we're going to use this opportunity to beef up those kinds of things to be able to do that. But also we're going to use this law to build up aspects of judicial management, because it was not there in 2005. How do you resuscitate a cooperative that is dying, which now you've got creditors who are all out to declare it a insolvent, and then at the same time, but it could be revived. It could be revived. So the judicial management was built in as a way of halting creditors to revive the cooperative if there is a possibility of revival. So all the developmental issues that were hanging were never addressed by the bill. We started building it. We didn't have institutional capacity to deal with some of the other issues and support and streamline the support for particular cooperatives, so that in the market, support for cooperatives was all over the place, confusing even the beneficiaries, not knowing where the support is located. So these institutions was to build our capacity, but also streamline the support. That's now the development character of the bill that we're building, plus some of the issues that are constraining development of cooperatives, which are compliance issues, to clarify them and make them clear in the bill. That's what informed the approach. On the issue of the RIA report, we will make the RIA report available. It does indeed articulate certain particular issues which it raises, but we've addressed all the issues of the RIA. So we're going to make the RIA report available to members as part of the report that will have references. We're going to send that attachment as well. Exactly, which is tomorrow. In fact, we will send that. Fiduciary duties, transparency of cooperatives. The bill has gone at length to make sure that managers abide by their fiduciary responsibility and they are transparent. On transparent assets, it insists that they must keep all their records for a period of about 5 years so that those records could be revisited. It begins also to say to them they must submit every year their financial reports to the CIPC so that it becomes a public known information. And it also says that they must be audited where they have to be audited, those that could accept, those that are at the level, they must be able to write accountability reports. So that, and then they must also comply with corporate governance principles so that they are able to be transparent, and even only when they are doing their activities, everything is transparent with them. So all those requirements in making sure that in their fiduciary duties, managers to execute those duties appropriately, the bill has been strengthened in that regard, and in fact, I think that is there are clauses that are there. Some of them have already touched on them that deals with this issue. First tier, second tier. At the moment, this is a challenge. We are having 13 in our database. We are having 13 tertiary cooperatives, and we are having plus minus 200 secondary cooperatives. Out of the 200 secondary cooperatives, almost plus minus 70% of these cooperatives are non-functional, the secondary ones. And then we investigated why is the case. The reason is this, very simple, is that when they were established, these cooperatives, they were never established because there was a need in the first place. They were established on the basis that, oh, we are cooperative in a given locality, let's create a secondary cooperative so that as you are, we can then go and be able to go and engage municipality, engage who, so that we can get the support through these secondary cooperatives. And in fact, most of these cooperatives, then you find that they are existing in paper form, but in real economic sense, they are not functioning. So it then dawned on us that the reason for that is that, first, the secondary cooperative must be created because among the primary cooperatives that must give rise to that secondary cooperative, there must be a need. And that need must clearly exist, and it must exist because in operation, these primary cooperatives have realized that they need market. And therefore, they discover that to access market is costly for them. Or they discover that to access input individually is very costly. There are advantages in them accessing these things collectively if they do that. Then the economic rationality is there. It's born immediately. Therefore, in that regard, you are able to therefore stop the creation of secondary cooperatives which are existing in paper, which are not having any economic rationality that is sound for their formation in the first place. Because you will be insisting on them to say, for you to be able to establish these, have the needs that are there for the entities that are able needed. But also, to create marketing cooperatives, you don't need a secondary cooperative. These things must take place in the primary cooperative itself. So that if you, for example, if you are having farmers who are producing individually, let's say they're having trusts, they're individual farmers, they must create these marketing cooperatives at the primary level. It's narrow that these things can only be operated at the level of secondary cooperatives was a malaise of the 2005 Act. That was the reason. So, in the real world, you're going to have that there are farmers, they are there, they are already producing. Therefore, when they are already producing, they are already in business, then they will be able to create a marketing cooperative because they are already existing. So, we are not hamstringing the development in that regard, as it was alluded to. And I think that those are the issues that left our leaders to address.
I'll tell you why, because we've got another presentation now, and I think what we're all going to have to do, that includes me, is we're going to have to be a little bit more succinct, shorter in our comments and responses. So what I want to do at this point, and thank heavens we've got you here for many weeks to come. The co-op situation is on the brink, so we don't have to worry, Mr. Nduma. Really, I'm sure you understand.
Yes.
I can hear how passionate you are. It's always difficult to get someone with passion away from the mic. So if I can just thank you very much, DDG Zikoda. You know, we do have other commitments to address. And co-ops are a very important issue here. And I don't want you to think they're not. That's why we want the rest of the information here by tomorrow afternoon so we can give it to members before they leave Parliament. I'm sure I'm looking at Honourable Mabasa as I say that. I know he would want that as well. So please, if we can do that, and if we can thank you, there are a lot of technical questions here, which I myself didn't ask. But I know that once we have all of your information, the technicalities of where to look, we'll come back to you with them. Thank you very much, DDG Zikoda, and if we can keep in touch with Mr. Hermans on what we require. Thank you. So, members, we will be dealing with this both in the subcommittee as well as the main committee. I hope this won't be an opportunity for members to leave the committee. We now have NAMISA, that is the National Metrology Institute of South Africa. I only see one name here, Mr. Benjamin van der Merwe, who's an acting CEO. I hope that's correct. And then we also have Mr. Donald Masuku, Head Technical Cooperation. I wonder if you could both come to the front to where your colleagues were sitting or next door. Just so that we can identify you. Thank you. Now, metrology is one of these entities. Am I correct, Honourable Kubasa, that was dealt with last year or earlier this year when the Honourable Khadebi chaired a meeting? Is that right? Did we have NAMISA here before? Yes. Oh, we intended having them and we didn't have them. Is that the idea? Right. Now, it's been some time then. It may even have been as long ago as 2009 that we've had you here, and it seems no sooner did we get a gift from you than we didn't ask you to come again. And I'm talking about the induction process. It was the last time I recall engaging with you. But it should not be a reflection on our interest or the value we believe you contribute to trade and industry. So you're very welcome. And am I understanding this correct, that Mr. van der Merwe, you will start off here, give us a bit of an overview. And then it's a very long presentation, but we don't want to miss too much. But try to be brief so that we get a clear understanding of what this is about. Thank you. Over to you. It's just 19 to 12.
Chair. Thank you, Honourable Madam Chair and Honourable Members. Chair. Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the opportunity to do this presentation. As stated, it's a rather long presentation because we try to cover everything and we will rather put emphasis on what we think is important and not skip but not put emphasis on the other slides. If you look at the outline of the talk, we'll talk about the MISA and metrology, our international metrology and the recognition, our regional and international continental role, the MISA, the technical areas, and then of course our support to the IPAC. Role and mandate of the MISA. The MISA's mandate to keep, maintain and disseminate the national MISA standards, and to demonstrate international equivalent for South Africa. We've got an Act, it's Act 18 of 2006. In addition, the MISA is responsible for the application of the maintenance of the units, or the SI, and the MISA also performs reference analysis in a dispute, and in any court of law, it will be accepted, those results will be accepted as the most correct value. History of the MISA was established in 1947, the National Physical Laboratory, we were then part of the CSIR, was later renamed to the National Metrology Institute, we were still part of the laboratory rather, we were still part of the CSIR, and then in 2007, we moved out of the CSIR and became our own public entity, so we're just turned five now. On the international scene, on August 1964, we signed a MINTA convention. This is a diplomatic treaty. Basically, at that stage, the National Bureau of Standards, all standards were still physical. It was kept in France and Seville, and they gave us access to that. Then later, we signed an international international committee for weights and measures, the CRPM, mutual recognition arrangement, in October 1999. This was a very landmark decision because this was the first time that there was a recognition or a signed document that different countries agreed to accept each other's measurements. And they started the database. So by proving your equivalent in one country, proving the comparisons of PD schemes, you get your measurement in an international database that is accepted internationally without questions from other countries. That was something of a landmark. And provides comparison for the national measurement standards against the national measurement standards of other nations and acceptance of calibration and measurement services by other signatories. So those last two parts is actually two in one. The vision, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on here, but it's sure that South Africa can prove measurement comparability and equivalence with the international community in support of trade in all national priority areas as well as the other areas and to promote a quality of life for all South Africans through accurate measurements in health and safety as well as law enforcement. So the whole concept is basically, if you look at this, is manufacture something in South Africa, gets measured here, or quantified here, if it's a chemical substance, and then it's open to the world. You can export it, doesn't have to be tested in another country again, you can export it because we've shown that we've got the capabilities. The reverse of that is also true that other countries now can export into your country without testing, but it's also the locking out mechanism in here, that you can now, inferior products, you can lock out. Just a more practical example of that, and I'm not going to go too much into detail. If you look, I'm just going to see it's on the right-hand side for most people. And in the MISA, South Africa, the MISA keep the national standards. Then SANAS, which is a national accreditor, make sure that through accreditation process, that we keep the national standards, we disseminate it as reference standards, the labs are accredited. SANAS, through ILAC, ensure that
the results are credible. So that just shows you that from one country compared to the one in the middle, Nesbitt, the U.S., the accreditation system is ANSI, that if a measurement is done in an accredited laboratory, doesn't matter if it's in South Africa or in the USA, those results, as long as you apply all the rules and you conform to all the rules, that those labs, the results be comparable. So we can accept those results. More practical example, maybe if you think of that national kilogram, that's the only SI unit that's still a physical standard that you can see, feel, and touch, the little platinum iridium cylinder. NEMISA, which is the National Measurement Industry of South Africa, will send our prototype to Paris and Zurich every 4 years. It comes back. We then use this to calibrate the rates of weight from 1 milligram to 20 kilograms. We then use those weights to calibrate standards for SANAS accredited laboratories, and then these guys get used in the end of the day in a shop in South Africa. Now, if you look on the right-hand side, which is unfortunately not very clear on the presentation, the top layer that I'm a little bit colorblind, so I sometimes struggle with the colors. Yellow, I think. It's NEMISA on the top layer. NEMISA ensures the traceability for the national measurement standards between the different countries. Then your accreditation body, in this instance, SANAS, make sure that at the laboratory level, those measurements are equivalent to the national measurement standard. And then your legal metrology organizations, in our case, NRCS, will make sure that in a shop floor condition. So that shows to you that a shop in South Africa, if you buy a kilogram of washing powder, it will be the same as a kilogram of washing powder in the US or in Europe, or similar liter of petrol that you purchase. The strategic objectives of NEMISA: to keep and maintain an equipment necessary for bringing national measurement standards and certify reference materials into being, to upgrade these existing national standards and to develop them further, to establish confidence in the accuracy thereof, to disseminate traceability and measurement expertise and services to the South Africa industry, to establish and maintain the necessary expertise and competence to keep on doing this function, and to participate and represent South Africa regionally and internationally with reference to traceability and measurement issues. On this slide, we just try to show the interaction, or I try to show the interaction between the technical infrastructure entities in DTI, which is South African Bureau of Standards, SANAS, NEMISA and NRCS, and then I'm not going to go into detail for it, but you can see which entity is responsible for one specific task. The main thing to remember here is that if you take any one of those four out, it will not work. The one underpins the other. There's an interrelationship between them that you cannot take away. Impact of metrology: it facilitates fair trade and international trade, underpins regulation, it improves quality of life, health and safety, law enforcement, etc., and it helps to meet social needs. I'll just highlight some of them. Any manufactured component needs to meet a specification. So if you've got a specification, that will be a South African Bureau of Standards task to have a published specification, and then you need measurements to make sure that it's done. Those measurements that you've done to prove equivalence or that you conformity to the specification, it's not done to a national measurement standard that's internationally equivalent, you cannot export it. Similar, if you look at legal methodology and how and weight and measures, if you look at underpinning regulation, regulation methodology is integral part of measurement measurement references for directive conformity assessment and verification. Again, in mostly legal methodology, improve quality of life, reliable medical, in this case both diagnostic and treatment-wise, as well as environmental monitoring. Food safety is becoming more and more on the forefront because of growth hormones, antibiotics, microtoxins, and so forth in food, especially not only for your internal or national use to make sure it's safe, but to export. EHS, noise levels, vibration levels, that's harmful to people, and then of course to protect us against inferior products, or importing of inferior products, dumping. Social needs, yeah, I'll just highlight, everybody nowadays gets these little headlights and little torches that got LEDs, light emitting darts in them, and they last anything between 7 to 21 times longer than a normal glow that you get in a normal torch. So on those kind of, we're setting up a facility to test that. Then of course, if we look at atomic clock research, just because of better time measurements, all have a GPS in our car now. You don't have accurate time measurements. Your GPS, the cheap ones that you buy for about R1,000, they're accurate about around 3 meters. They will not be accurate. They will be accurate to 3 kilometers if you don't have accurate time measurements. Sorry. Okay. if we look at regional and interactions, we started off in the 1990s with SADC. It's basically the countries on the equator and the south. It's part very similar to the SADC trading block, and we start uplifting and being involved in the NMIs of those countries. At that specific stage, most of these countries had fairly rudimentary weights and measures or trade metrology facilities and nothing more. We've been been busy in projects with them and upliftment. It has now grown to that the whole of Africa got a regional metrology organization called AfriMet. That is in 2008, where we played a leading role. We were up to last year, we were the chair of it. Now we're standing back and give more support. The different colors there is the different sub-regions in it. That's not really important for this. I've already explained most of this, our support role and our infrastructure building, so I'm not going to spend time on this. If you look at serving the nation, what it in the MISA products and services that we deliver, first of all, it's the national measurement standards that we have. So that's primary standards, and we use those to calibrate primary standards, secondary standards, working standards, and then, of course, the traceability measurements that are traced by the industry. Then we also talk about reference methods, especially in the field of chemistry, and this is to disseminate in our national measurement standards to ensure that we internationally benchmark our measurements to on a continued process. Validate that we can do it. These international benchmarkings might take place every 5 or 10 years, so they need to be processed in place for a period in between to ensure continued competence. This is the validation or the validating we're talking about. And then we supply reference, certified reference materials. Reference standards, that's what we do for the accreditation, accredited robotics out there, legal metrology, some direct industry, we do the consultation. I'm not going to do for a whole of consultation. We go to knowledge dissemination and collaboration. We publish papers. We participate in conferences, both nationally and internationally. We've got training courses. And then, of course, we have exchange programs with other institutes as well. And then benchmarking, the highest level of that is at the BIPM, CIPM level. Then regional AfriMet, and we can also do bilaterals with other countries, and then we run PT schemes. PT schemes is to ensure competence between laboratories within South Africa nationally. That's the difference. The IPM. It's most of these, unfortunately, come from the French, and it's the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. And CIPM is a committee, an international committee for weights and measures. If we look at our structure, we as organizations just went through a reorganization progress, not a restructuring, a reorganization progress, where we just look at the way that our organization is structured and reorganized it to align it with our 5-year strategy plan and a 3-year annual plan. And if you look, you'll see that we've got 21 laboratories, of which 22 laboratories, of which 21 is accredited to ISO 17025. Of that 21, 2 is also accredited to ISO Guide 54. So it's not a mathematical calculation. Error that if you add it up, we've got one laboratory that doesn't help any accreditation currently. We've got a staff complement of 106. You can see we've got a CEO, currently only an acting one. Then we've got a normal support around that. Health, if you look at Quest, health and safety, and our quality systems. We've got internal audit and a compliance office, And then we get to the divisional level, the green level. And you'll see that of those 7, 6 is basically, or 5.5 is technical areas. So we've got our non-technical, which is finance and corporate services. Then we split all our technical functions between chemistry division, physical metrology, electricity and magnetism, and ionized radiation. Those four form the core of the organization technically. Then in a supporting technical role, we've got research and development, and then our technical infrastructure development. So this is 99% or 95% completed. There's one or two positions that still needs to be finalized. Just some photographs, I'll run quickly through it to show you some of our national measurement. NMS for time, that's a cesium clocks. It works on how cesium deteriorates over time. So that is how we do it, to measure time. The two lasers, NMS for length, that they use to realize the meter width. At the bottom, NMS for force, this is a force machine. The one on the extreme left, the big one you see a little part of, that can put down a pressure of 500 elephants. That's 5 meganewton. And then the NMS for mass, this is, as I said, the only physical artifact still that you find. All of the others are realized. And this is a little cylinder of platinum uranium. We've got also national measurement standards for ionizing radiation. That is for both therapy as well as treatment, x-rays, and so forth. And it's just the two different specific equipment. You can see the one that looks like a cylinder with little things. Different sources around it that are radioactive. Look at products and services. This is more to our chemistry department, where we give certified reference materials. This is different ones of them, sodium fluoride, aqueous ethanol certified reference material, and then gas reference materials. These reference materials we set up, some of them are pure. I'll explain later the difference between them. Some might be in a matrix, but it's just if you've got an analytical machine. You take this and you can put it through the machine, you know what values you should get, and you can compare it to what you do get, and you can do your calibration. The one where the guy is in, this is the breakalyzer calibration, traded one for a lot of people, the trackers. This is what we calibrate for the law enforcement agencies to test people for drinking and driving. So, I'm just going to spend a little bit of time on chemistry because they're slightly different to the other three. In the sense that the other three get physical standards in any or a piece of machinery or equipment that you can see. Here you don't see it. So chemistry, basically, they've got two main products. The one is reference measurements and the other one is reference materials. Now, reference measurements, this is basically, reference measurements, this is basically physically where you calibrate instrumentation through, and where they calibrate instrumentation. This is things like ozone meters, stack emission analyzers, flow analyzers, breathalyzers, etc. And then there's the samples slash PT or PT, PT stands for proficiency schemes, and this is in environmental, food and healthy. So what it basically is, we provide samples for these schemes. Some are run by us, ourselves, but some are actually run by industry sectors themselves in the food industry. So we'll make up specific samples that they need. It's got a known value. It will be sent up between the different laboratories, maybe grand laboratories or whatever, and they'll make sure that they get the same result. Or if they start class, then they can address it. So that's the reference measurement class. The reference materials, here we basically, as I said, we manufactured a reference material, and it's basically just two, it's a pure mixture or a matrix. A pure mixture is just like alcohol. So we have an alcohol or platinum. It's a pure mixture. But then we also put a mixture in a matrix or a solution. Because if you look, think of CSI and those screens that show you all the peaks, when you put a mixture in solution, the shape and the amplitude and the size will change. So we took both of them. And then you look at the last one, that's microtoxins in maize and toxic elements in wheat. Those are the really bad guys because they are carcinogenic and they give you cancer. Just for example, like Lesotho, it's got the highest percentage of throat cancer in the world. And it's related directly to the way that they store their maize products, which allow fungi to grow in them, which cause microtoxins, and that is where it comes from. So what we do, what we don't do, this is what we do. We don't standardize, but we do assist with the drafting of South African national standards. We do not regulate, but we help in those regulations are formed to guide people to what is attainable limits and ranges. Legislation, we don't legislate, but if you think of the breath analyzers, we provide measurement framework for that to operate in. We do not prosecute, but we provide accurate measurements. We do not accredit it, but we conduct benchmarking processes or exercises to support accredited laboratories. We do not do general calibration or testing, but we do perform high-level or referee analysis in disputes. NMR, ESA, and IPA. NMISA provides and develops accurate measurement or metrology capacity to support, create, or scaling up of industries and products. And basically, there's four things that we do. We provide technical support for exports. We provide, we assist to improve competitiveness. We perform advanced measurements for industry and prove and provide certificates of analysis for export products. And we develop measurement facilities not available in South Africa. For example, in energy efficient lamps. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. It's a rather busy slide, but it just gives you an idea of the different industry sectors that we're involved in. ITC, manufacturing, aerospace and defense, advanced materials, agricultural, cultural industries and tourism, automotive, plastics and pharmaceuticals and chemicals, health and metal fabrication. If you look at meeting food and health safety regulations, you'll see there. We look at the nutritional content, microtoxins, pesticide residues, especially in fruit, legendary drug residues, processing contaminations, and environmental chemicals. And here I can just use a practical example. South Africa used to be able to export red meat to Europe. I'm not sure, but about 2 years ago, it is red meat excluding game and ostrich meat, which follows a different route. At that stage, the capability to do these tests were with one of the technical infrastructure entities, and we provided them with the traceability. Then there was a decision to take it away and make it part of an organization outside of it. And a year or two later, when a European delegation came here to look at the capability of that, they decided it's not good enough. Currently, we can't export food to or red meat to Europe. So these kind of things that can go wrong very quickly, and then it's very difficult to restore them again. Ionizing and radiation, we all know about the treatment part and the diagnostic part with it. But there
mining. Just back in South Africa, we mine very deep for gold, so people are exposed there. So it's not just the hospital and nuclear plants, but it's regulatory bodies and the mines and whatever as well. And so we do monitoring of that, and we're busy with the to set up with the nuclear regulator to set up a monitoring system throughout South Africa. We're assisting them with that. Major interventions, again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but we can see we're involved in it, the petroleum and mining industry, pharmaceuticals, nanotechnology, automotive, we're very big in the automotive industry, quality of life, chemical industry, plastics and packaging, produce, food sector, environmental, air pollution, and then GH. Now, I've got so many acronyms on. Greenhouse gases. Thank you. The next slide I'm really going to scan through, because this is our interventions that we started when the first time we came into with IPAP or IPAP 1. We then went through a process to see the different sectors, where can we evolve in, and start identifying what we should do. What I want to say here, at this stage, we realize that to do what we at that stage envisaged that we want to do, we realize that we have to either buy new equipment or replace old, outdated or broken equipment, and we established that will be to a cost of 105 million. So far, we've been very lucky that last year the DTI itself fund at least fund 25 million for us, so we're on track there. But I'll rather spend time on the other slide we described the our current involvement and the feedback on it. So I'm just going to skip through these two. If you look at our IPAP programs, and what we try and show in this slide is, if you look on your left-hand side, you'll see that there's three boxes with little red letters on it. That's cesium clocks, or atomic clocks. And we want to place it with a fluorescent comb or lasers. Your advantage is that you can keep time just as accurate, but you can prefer frequency comb, you can calibrate lasers, you can calibrate optical fiber, etc. So there's this whole movie metrology. It's one of those fields that it's very old, but in the last couple of years there's been a whole move, and that's very capital intensive. We basically organize our priority plans or action plans against the three priority sectors as identified by the DTI, which is the green energy or efficient energy, agro-processing, and metal fabrication, but we also added the fourth one for ourselves, which is called other. And in there, you can quickly see that if you go to the top, green energy, develop standards and measurement facilities for energy-efficient lamps, improve humidity standards, and test humidity and temperature, very important in manufacturing, gas primary reference mixture for emission monitoring, upgrade power and energy measurement standards. We look at agro-processing, persistence organic pollutions, or POPs, environmental and compliance monitoring of a facility for toxic chemicals, toxins in food and environment, certified reference materials for pesticides in food, heavy metals in wheat, and microtoxins in maize. And maybe I can just stand still here a little bit and explain. We talk about persistent organic pollutants. The difference between them and normal pesticides is a normal pesticide may be the spray that you're using in your house to metal, but will break down. After a certain period, there's nothing, it's gone. Persistent organic pollutants don't break down, they just dilute. But they're there. Once they're there. Now, most of your persistent pollutants you can measure, and once you go to the part per million or part per 10 million, and you don't measure it anymore, it's not a problem anymore. But if you look at your microtoxins, then you've got a problem, because here you look at parts per billion or even parts per trillion. Those things are just so bad for you that you look at it at that level. And that's why you need the specialized equipment, and that's why nowadays, when we start measuring for it, they haven't measured for it 10 years ago. Nobody asked for it when you export food. We've got to set up processes.
phases to make sure I could measure these correctly. Metals fabrication, develop advanced measurement capabilities for minerals, advanced materials and metal alloys, X-ray diffraction in support of the automotive industry, but more so in the cutting edge field of nanotechnology, and then, as I said, automotive industry, we're busy with the commissioning or the procurement of a high accuracy coordinate measuring machine. It's a big 3D machine that measures automotive parts quite accurately. Around this machine for automotive and aerospace industry, and then we're busy with nuclear and health. We procured a new X-ray, National Measurement Standard for the Symmetry. That's the symmetry. That is just a measurement of radiation, basically. I'm sorry, ma'am. Okay. The symmetry is the measurement of radiation. It's basically those that you measure. Here, and there's a whole lot of slides because that is pretty specific of exactly for each and every sector what we do. And if you look at the top, it explains what we do in 2011-12, so that's what we done last year, and then to the bottom you'll see 2012-13, and that is what we plan to for this year. So the column on the left is your time period, then it's your next column is what's planned, and then it's progress or what is on it. So if you look at measurement for air pollution, we increase our reference, our suite of reference gases for gas mixes that we use in industry to calibrate instruments that monitor the quality of air. We also improve our humidity and temperature capability. What we plan for this year is to improve our airflow standard, because most of the pollution measurements goes with so many parts per cubic meter of air. So that's why the two. And of course, humidity and the temperature plays a role in that as well. So we upgrade our national measurement for airflow. We will test and benchmark our new humidity generator, and then we're going to purchase a new resistant bridge. This is very technical. It's just that you actually use electrical measurements in temperature. A measurement facility for energy efficient lamps. It goes about as light emitting diodes. So we started last year, and we're part of the SAPS committee, on the ISO committee, where they introduced these standards and set up standards, and now we move into the process where we basically establish the competency in the measurement of photometric properties of liquid light emitting diodes. Now, we're not doing this on our own because this is quite deep worldwide, so we involve the academia of a couple of universities here to help us to establish this facility. National standards for power and energy. From last year, we've involved mainly with ESCOM to increase our ranks in the ampere, so the current measurements that we can do, and we increase it up from 50 ampere up to 100 ampere. So we want to increase it up to 150, 160 ampere. This is mainly on the system, on insistence of the of ESCOM. Monitoring capability for toxic chemical substances in fish and food exports. As I've already mentioned, the example here we have of red meat, but also now on a fish level, European Union has indicated to us that they want certain measurements done for to measure for toxins, dioxins in fish, which we cannot really do at this moment, but at least they alerted us to this fact. So we're busy developing these standards in conjunction with CSIR and testing itself in the end of the day will be most possible. Be done mostly by SAPS. Similarly,
I just wondered, just to sort of get this down on ground level for all of us. Now, just looking at that right here, when you were talking about the capability for toxic chemical substances, fish, fruit, and export, you earlier said the problem with taking it down to the ground is the fish would be affected by this by not being able to test. In how, what's the impact on being able to export? Because I think you've indicated we're not testing for all of it to the same level or degree. What does this mean? What does it mean for us here as a country exporting? Does it mean we can still export our fish? We can't, or are there impediments?
Currently we can still export, but there's a new European directive out where new requirements are. And you can basically see that as a TBT, if you like. So they alerted to us, and that's why we're setting this up. So in 2 or 3 years, when this comes to an effect, we've already got a capability at that stage to do it. Similarly, if you look at heavy metals in maize and wheat, most of this is for public, it's for export as well, but also to protect our own public. As I said, some of these are carcinogenic, so if you find these trace elements in it or you don't control the process, people actually expose all this high possibility that they might get cancer. Biofuels, this is very big. There's a lot of concerns around it starting to make an impact on the food supplies of the countries. So that's why we talk about, I'm not sure if it's here, but we talk about origin and where it comes from. So, and also everybody makes biofuels to make sure that you've got the right properties. So we're busy, especially in Brazil, in a collaborative process to try and get standards for these biofuels and a standard for South Africa that's internationally acceptable. Advanced materials. This one is going to be difficult. I'll rather skip this one if you don't mind. I can't find a practical example down to this. Advanced materials is mostly composites. And what it basically is that materials has changed, and the testing of materials has changed. 15 years ago, most measurements in this field were static. So somebody, if you want to measure, for instance, hardness, you had an indenter, think of something like a hammer with a point, and you hit something with a certain force, and then you can measure the indentation. Today, this doesn't happen anymore. You've got all these new, wonderful metals that will return to the whatever. So we change from static measurements to dynamic measurements. And that's very difficult because you can't go back and you can measure it. And this is basically what we're looking at here as an advanced. If you look at your nanotechnology and your nanostructures, exactly how they do and how they bind. So this is the work that we do in that field. X-ray diffraction in support of automotive and cutting edge. Again here, it's just an X-ray. If you have pictures, you can basically take the material and you can get a picture and you can see how it works. So this relates to the previous example that I used. Mass goes through right through everything. And so as I said, from if you go to the butcher and you buy a kilogram of but also mass, volume, and density, they're interrelated. So to upgrade and viscosity, so to upgrade those three fields, you've got to upgrade mass first. And so we're busy to upgrade our mass facility to a higher level, and in principle it's just in support actually of the other industries, and also chemistry as well. Dimensional standards, this is a CMM, a coordinate measuring machine. This is a big 3D measuring machine. What happens here is more and more in South Africa we find that OMS, automotive suppliers, manufacturer suppliers, make components. We all know that we make a lot of cars in South Africa. But we also make an incredible amount of components, analytic converters. Here Adani and Katya, as one of the extremely big export, magnesium wheels for cars. So those kind of things. And that is where we assist them. We can do these measurements. They do cat designs, they manufacture, and then they bring it, and we can measure it up to a couple of microns, 1/100 of a hair breadth, to see if it's really what they want, and compare it. X-ray standards, this is purely for better diagnostics, and of course, more so for health services. Because if your source is not calibrated right, when you go in for an X-ray, they will fry you. Fry. Burn. You'll get burned by exposure.
The entire committee falls asleep. Provide measurement standards for telecommunications. You can just briefly go over those. There's focus a little on the SCAR. I was told you mustn't call it SCAR, it creates the wrong perception, SKA. So just how the fibre optics, you know, how does that relate to where we're going in this field and so on, and your relationship as metrology. Thank you.
Fibre optic and time measurements, if you think of maybe the things like the SKA project. If you have a telescope or a square kilometer array of these, to get this information in real time and to know where they exactly are, so that you need extremely accurate time measurements. There's a delay in everything. Micro or fiber optics, you delay is a lot less. And for example, in a normal copper wire, but there is a delay. So there's a whole lot of development around that, and we actually at the moment got a special project with SKA. We've been involved with them from the CAT and the MEERKAT and our SKA process to this. So this is driven mostly by telecommunications, internet connections, wireless connections. This is driven by this. It's from the communication field. And here I've already mentioned the SKA project that we're involved in.
That's quite an important one here. You haven't numbered the pages, but the NMS and support to SCAR guide the procurement of the hardware required. I think that's a very important part of the process.
As I said, we've been involved in the beginning. It was the dimensional measurement of the mulch for the dishes, for the foundation, so we're involved in that process right from the start. Monitoring hazardous substances, polymers, plastic, and packing material. Plastic or polystyrene, it's wonderful things to package it. Unfortunately, it contaminates. The only thing I want to leave this committee with is, just believe me, never ever put anything plastic in your microwave to heat up something. It's bad. Doesn't matter what they tell you on that container, microwave-friendly, not a good idea. I don't have a doctorate in chemistry. I'm an electrical engineer. But the people from chemistry explained this to me. It's really not a good idea to put plastic in a microwave. Yes, or glass. Not plastic. Doesn't matter what a manufacturer tells you. Don't believe it. Don't cover it with plastic. If you want to cover it with something, use a towel, a roll, or whatever. It's bad. That's it.
I've had to dredge up our physics. Mine was like 50 years ago when I last did physics and chemistry. But that has been very constructive for us. It's given us some idea, but I think members may have quite a few questions. I would certainly like you, as you're responding, just to give an example. They're not really numbered, but the International Food and Safety, etc., I think meat came up, and wine, etc. When you said something like, well, now we can't export our meat now, and a couple of years, and it's very difficult for us to be able to do it again. Tell us why, because that is what we need to know here, so we can try and address it. Give us some examples of these areas, as difficult as they may be. You spoke about photonics, you spoke about energy-efficient lamps, and I'm learning from you right now, up until now, we haven't really known how efficient they are. Right now, because you're only developing it. Yeah, give us this kind of information. If we're going to sell stuff to people and try and promote it, we need to be giving them more accurate information in this regard. And the last time when we visited you folks, well, the first and only time in 2009, I was told that part of your machinery was due to go through the floorboards and needed to be repaired. Now, you've made no mention of that. Have you replaced all these floorboards? Right, thank you. So let's take the question. Honourable James, Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It was, I wasn't asleep. Just two comments. The first is to ask how much of the testing is done by yourself, by universities, by the CSIR, and so on. I mean, what's the distribution of the testing facilities in the country? Firstly, and secondly, are there foreign testing agencies here? For example, does the EU test for our product here? And in fact, and do they therefore question the credibility of the testing that we do? If you can just speak about that, because there is great consequences for clearly our meat exports. I mean, there are areas where of the country in the Northern Cape where ostriches have never been exposed to the virus that they're exposed to in the Western Cape, and why do they have a blanket ban on all ostrich meat, for example? So, and just thirdly, I'm particularly interested in the area of chemistry testing for organic toxins as they affect health. I mean, you referred to the incidence of throat cancer among the people of Basutu. I mean, the rat poison that is taken today, called warfarin, was extracted from hay that was stored in the southern part of Canada during a particularly strange part of the season, and it produced a toxin called coumadin. And that is was first used for rat poison, and now it's for human use to make blood thin. And so, are you therefore on top of organic forms of toxins that are produced by food and other kinds of agricultural produce, given the nature of the seasons that we have in southern Africa and the food that's produced?
Honourable James, Honourable Mabasa, followed by Honourable
Elbert. Oh, yes. No, thank you very much. I would like to know how does your unit relate to rural places, to informal settlements. I'm selecting those specifically because those are the places where health severely under threat, water, sewage, you know, that area. And then the second one is how do you see your role in SMMEs and cooperatives, especially because you were part of listening to the input on cooperatives. I hope that you have already identified your niche there. Thanks,
Colin
Chair.
Well, Elvin? Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to know a little bit more about, in terms of agro-processing, the toxins that's used, especially at silos, whether you are involved with that at all, and also in some way protecting workers in toxic environment that works with these things, whether it's the agro-processing or whether it's mining or whatever the case may be, and what your role might be possibly with regard to mine water, what the mining water problem we have in South Africa at the moment, whether you're in any way involved there with ascertaining exactly the acidity levels of the water and so forth, and going forward, what your involvement will be in terms of mining and especially fracking in South Africa, if there would be any involvement from your side. And then perhaps just as a matter of interest, tell us a little bit more about the nanotechnology work that you are doing. Thank you.
Right. And just before me add one more thing, you mentioned you have three colors, green, red, and orange, with respect to NAMESA's contribution to IPA and interventions needed. If you could just perhaps highlight the critical ones which require intervention. There are about three or four pages or two pages of this. Do you remember? Okay. So over to yourself then, and just respond to them in any order whatsoever. Thanks.
Thank you. Maybe I should just give a little bit of background in a sense that the NAMESA, we keep the national measurement standards. So we don't see ourselves to become a center where testing has been done. That's other organizations like the African Bureau of Standards, the Commercial Era, ARC, the Agricultural, and the veterinary people. But they cannot do those testing if they don't have the national standards. In some instances, because certain capacity is not there, we will do directly. But the whole idea is that it should actually be done by other organizations, because it's not our role to set up a big testing facility. We might start it and then roll it up to others. We might be involved in it, if I can use the environment, air pollution issue. South Africa is busy in the process of setting up a whole air pollution system throughout the country, and we will be involved in that. But it will not be our main drive to do this. That will be the departmental drive, and we'll do certain actions in it, even training and having certain standards in it. So when we talk about testing and a testing distribution, we actually will do very little of the testing in the sense of we don't get all the wine in South Africa and bottles and taste it. But we will participate internationally in comparisons to do those tests. So we will then have a validated method we can give the industry. We'll give them reference material so that they calibrate their own equipment and they can do it, and they can then on themselves, via also the accreditation process, do these tests, and products can then be exported. Foreign testing, the only foreign testing that I know about that is fairly big or mentionable in South Africa is on the automotive side. It seems like there is, although all these agreements, and similar to the aircraft industry, it's like they've got their rules of their own. We struggle a little bit with it. We're winning field in the automotive industry directly through the mother companies like BMW, Mercedes, that they accept our calibration. But although we can prove to them that they are accredited and we've got a national standard, they still want to come in and see and talk to the people. Similar in the aviation industry, but the American is very big, but we've won some battles there as well. When it comes to the chemistry, I'll just use maize and wheat. We work with the wheat board and the maize board. We've got collaborative projects with them to address these issues. They'll come to us and state to us what measurements they've got problems with, what mycotoxins they can't measure, and we will help them. In most instances, they have the necessary expertise and people and equipment. If needed, we'll provide training and we'll provide reference materials. There is one or two cases because, as I said, if you think of things like mycotoxins, where you're looking
$1.2 trillion. Worldwide, people are struggling with those methods, right, to really measure those things on a reliable scale. If I can use and that's the difference between chemistry and physical metrology, electricity, I can use the example. If I talk about physical metrology, if I've got a kilogram, I can test it, I can put it on a balance 10 times, and I can get an average. If I want to measure ampere, I can measure a couple of times. Chemistry, bit of a dark art. Because if you measure something, most probably in the process of measurement, you either destroy it or it grows. So if you start counting and count it again, it will be more because it grows in the meantime. So it becomes a very difficult field to work in. So there, it's not physical standards, it's actually methods that you use that's incredibly important. And to validate those methods that you use, that the equipment is of course important, but it doesn't help you at all if you don't have the necessary expertise. So we see our role is to establish that expertise in South Africa. Not necessarily in our own institute, but at a university or the grading board or wherever. That is how we see it. Relating to rural and informal settlements, I can use the example most probably of low-cost housing or RDP houses. Because of the lack of testing in that field, more than 60% of those houses isn't up to standard. 50% gets rebuilt. The regulations are there, everything is there, but it's not implemented, it's not forced down. That is not our task, to go and say, but if a contractor built the RDP house, you've got to bring your steel to us. People import substandard steel and whatever, and that's why all of a sudden we get hurricanes in the Eastern Cape all the time, because the roof blows off. Not really like the hurricanes, it's just that it's bad quality. So yes, there is a role for us to play, and most probably don't play it well enough. But I would, with that one and the SMEE, with the permission of the chair, this is our SMEE and rural person, so I think he can ask it better at telling exactly how we're involved, if you don't mind. Donald.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on the question relating to informal settlements and water storage, maybe I'll also pass it on to our DDG, Dr. Chenge Dimana. I think he asked that maybe he could help us with that. But I will respond on the SMME and the work that we do with the cooperatives. With the SMMEs, I think we have identified our role there in terms of really assisting the SMMEs to understand the importance of quality in general and also measurements in particular. We have a program that we've actually rolled out in the rest of the SADC region, which is actually an improvement toolkit guide that we give to SMMEs for them to understand the importance of metrology and measurements and how they can improve their production and competitiveness in terms of the products that they have to export overseas. So what we plan is to work with the Small Enterprise Development Agency, SEDA, through the DTI, to work with all the provincial or regional offices in all the 9 provinces to roll out this improvement toolkit to all the SMEs in the provinces, and also to train the business advisors themselves within SEDA for them to be the contact point in terms of the information that SMEs would need, and then they can pass that information through to us at NMISA, and then we can work directly with the SMEs. First, in terms of identifying what are their measurement needs in the various sectors, and how can we then assist those SMEs in terms of their measurement needs. So we do have this program. We have a toolkit that we're going to be rolling out to all the SMEs in the 9 provinces. I think the other question, like I said, we can maybe ask our Dr. Chenge Dimana to assist us with that.
Just to acknowledge, I think I wasn't aware earlier that the chief director is a doctor or Mr. Chenge Dimana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm a chief director at DTI in the Industrial Development Division.
I'm actually the line manager that administers the act for NIMISA and the SAPS and SANA and the NRCS. As we are aware, metrology is the science of measurement. So they are really the foundation for all measurement that takes place in our country. And their role is to make sure that our measurements are equivalent to those of the international system. So their work, one of the key challenges that even their board has identified is the accessibility of their work to the general public. And so when it comes to how they relate to rural areas, informal settlements, the board has tasked them to really look hard this year in terms of making themselves known, bring awareness to the public, and try to get more people from previously disadvantaged backgrounds are coming into the institution as interns so that they can experience the NIMISA as such. So the program of getting graduate interns into NIMISA, they have to be graduates and they have to be science graduates, of course. It's one of the key programs that they are implementing this year. Just that in the presentation that was given, the numbers were not given. And I don't recall the numbers myself, how many actually per area. So, yeah, I think that's important. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. If we can just complete then, Mr. van der Merwe or Mr. Masuku.
Sorry. When it comes to agro processing, again, there are port and other mechanisms in place that will control the whole system. But we will help them set up, again, the expertise and the tests, and even what is internationally acceptable. But so in exceptional cases, as I said, we will do the measurements if there's nobody else that can do it. But our idea is not. That should be the functions of that specific departments or boards. But we are more willing, and we, as I said, we've got a big collaborative project currently going with the Grain Board, currently working on uplifting their measurements and expertise and instrumentation to the international acceptable level, and also to implement the correct. When it comes to water and mining and water that's been polluted because of mining, we run proficiency schemes, meaning that we send out samples to all the different participating municipalities, city council in South Africa, and they will then do these testy samples. So we help them to ascertain or establish the capabilities of these different organizations. Currently, this is basically how far as it goes. How they treat it afterwards, we don't have a control over, but that's maybe something we can get involved in. Nanotechnology, if I can quickly mention it, we see our main focus here is providing standards. There's a lot of instrumentation that get used out in the field, scanning probe instruments, atomic force, microscopes, and so forth. And people do a lot of research at universities, at nano centers on this, and they publish papers. 4 years ago, we ran an inter-comparison, and we realized that these the answers for the same artifact differs by more than a factor of 1,000 between these universities. So now you start wondering what's the worth of the paper that's been published. So that's what we see, is to bring the measurements, whatever, not the development of the technology per se, but make sure that the measurement underpins that development and it means something. So that's our role in nanotechnology. Yes.
Well, you must be somewhat relieved on that note of yes. But, you know, Mr. van der Merwe, what I'm going to ask, and I want you to come back on this, no doubt all other members managed to get a clear understanding
of the gaps, in critical gaps that you're experiencing and actually being able to contribute to the IPAP. I'm not getting that loud and clear, because at the one point you spoke about funding, you know, being an impediment. I also happen to know the floorboards were rotten. You know, I'm just not getting some concrete information. I'm hearing about the work you've done quite in depth or hoping to do or can do, but I'm also hearing that there are lots of areas that at this stage either cannot be done because of equipment or cannot be done because actually the processes themselves are no longer static, they're dynamic in terms of chemical issues. And if we could get this quite clear, and then we're also hearing really just from Mr. Masuku or yourself, I'm not sure about the housing, that while housing is not under our mandate, etc., the committee, nevertheless, you spoke about, you know, part of the reason why these roofs are going off, etc., is because the specifications are not complied with. Now, once you will then test this, but you're not going to test everything there. You're not going to be inspecting the housing. I must assume that the specs, the safety specs are given to whoever is involved in the inspectorate of that REP house, to put it simply. So are we then saying that this is a challenge that the housing portfolio should look into? You see, that is, housing doesn't fall directly under us, but we're saying we think the metal, you know, whatever it was not up to spec, and that's why the roof blew off, etc. How can we help and integrate what we learn here with housing?
How much of your information goes out to them? Somebody who manufactures, who makes bricks, should go to your publication and say, let me just quickly check whether the brick I make is of the standard that is allowed, or any other building material for that matter. Just how accessible is the information that you have?
Thank you, Dr. Bartha. Yes.
Okay, I'll first start on equipment and an e-trigger. I've mentioned that we identified that we need 105 million. That is just to sort out critical, or to be able to procure critical equipment to help with the addressing that needs has been identified in ARPAP. But parallel to that, we are busy with a recapitalization program. The recapitalization program entails a new building, and I'll come back to why we mentioned new building, as well as new equipment, because of this movement in metrology. If you think of most fields, especially in the chemistry, if you buy a piece of equipment, it's almost like software. The day you buy it, it's almost already outdated. So 3 years down the line, it's old, and 5 years it's obsolete. Your supplies will not even support it anymore. So it's a very capital intensive industry or milieu to be in. So what we've done is we've started a process to identify the new equipment that we need, but we also realize that you need specialized buildings. If you look at this type of equipment, you need clean rooms. Currently sit in buildings that were called office blocks, so the buildings is contaminated. You cannot build a clean room. We build a clean room now. We just finish it now. We take basically a room like this and we build a clean room in the middle of it, because that's the only way we can do it to get it. So it's a question of, in certain instances, even if we get equipment, we cannot perform the test because the environment is wrong. You think of things not only clean, but temperature gradients. Your building is building wrong, and one can't get sun all the time and the other side doesn't, you've got a problem. If it's too close to overhead power lines, if it's too close to a big road, you've got a problem because it's vibration. So you need a very specialized building to really take it to the next level. So that is why we're currently in a process of a recapitalization process for both a building and equipment. We're looking at different options. Currently, we're busy with PPP. We did receive money, not this year, but next year. But we, from our own coffers and cuts, we want to try to start appointing a project, project officer to start some of the feasibility studies. We've done a whole lot of work ourselves that we took to Treasury and to PPP. So it's not that we just need it. We actually did a whole work ourselves to see what our labs is and so forth, and take a big presentation to them. So this is something really big. This is millions of rands. We've been in the last couple, when we started out, we mentioned it to the Aditya Institute. In the last couple of weeks, we've been contacted by SANEF, the National Accreditator, that said they want to come onto the band because they don't have their own facilities. So there's this, we'll have to see what exactly how it ends up, but there's this possibility of a TI campus or whatever. But it's a need. We can only take where we are currently with our equipment, it's only so far. And it's not always that easy just to replace the equipment. Some of the equipment, we've also got to be careful because once you install it, you cannot really uninstall it and take it. It will cost you the same as new equipment because it comes from overseas. So it's a delicate situation when it comes to that. That was the first question. The second question, part of the question.
On the housing.
I'll take another example. When we talk about motor or automotive industry, one of the things that gets manufactured in South Africa is leather seats. And the stitching is important. And we help them with that. And in a textile industry, we developed wool fiber diameter meter. That is a lot cheaper than it's been through the whole process. We've got a patent on it. The prototype is now out in industry. But we've got to do more like, especially in the rural areas. And most probably that's part of the problem, that the testing doesn't get done, because if you buy the off-the-shelf solutions to do this testing on the bricks and whatever, they're just too expensive for the smaller contractors out there. So that's where I see we can play a role in the future, is to help with that kind of testing or development of that kind of testing instrumentation that will make it a lot easier. So it might not be an unwillingness to do it, it's too expensive for the people to do it, that's why they don't do it.
Know what we're going to do here, because I can see we really need to re-engage you on a lot of issues. The one on the one side was raised by yourself, Honourable James, as to who we're working with. You know, you can't do all of it yourself, so you indicated you weren't doing that, but how many more universities or CSIR can you engage to assist in part of this work, number one. Number two, on the accessibility, which the Honourable Mabasa and Honourable Kwabasa had raised together in this area, how do we, on the one hand, make people who, for want of a better word, in rural areas are much more aware, from the informal, the previously disadvantaged group of people, much more aware of the importance, but also how can we reduce the cost? So make it more accessible, not only in terms of knowing about it, awareness, but also costing of the whole thing. The third thing is there any way in working with, say, the housing departments and the inspectorate and the construction companies, is there any way there that they could perhaps assist a fellow who wants to just provide a few bricks for the local school to be built, etc.? How does that fellow get, or woman for that matter, get ready access to your information? Is there something in the construction industry itself can do as part of their social responsibility? The third thing is relating to this, you know, up here it's a lot clearer to read than what I've got down here. The matrix you've got here, what does the orange, the red, the green represent? Perhaps you can rejig the matrix a little to indicate what kind of intervention. Is it a cost intervention? Is it a this? What is the intervention that may be required? Can we get a little bit more specific in that area in relation to IPAP,
on the trading side, which is also part, you know, sort of on the other side of the coin, you spoke about meat, there's also vegetables, there's many other things. Are you aware of the actual trading sections that this impacts on? And if not, let me know so that we can work with DDG Karim to try and get that information so that we don't have silos of information. That's what we've got at the moment, a little bit here. When we go overseas, we can't quite see the connection to what's coming up in Geneva. So I think if you can, as a department, assist us in trying to synthesize, draw together the different pieces of information. Because I do think metrology is, at the moment, it's probably not seen as something that is all that essential, and yet it is. It's essential to industrialization, it's essential to trade, and it is essential to people's health and well-being and safety. But we're not actually getting that at the moment. So I'm going to now invite you back in the second or third quarter, whatever it is, and I'm sure our committee secretary would look at a suitable time for this. But meanwhile, members, if there are any areas you'd like to have raised, if you can raise them with Mr. Herman so we can send this in a written communication back to NAMESA. But I really, you know, did find it very interesting myself. I wish one had more time. And I would really like to thank you, Mr. van der Merwe, the acting CEO, Mr. Masuku, the head of the technical cooperation, and Mr. Shinga Damani, who is the chief director, am I correct there? DTI. Thank you very much. And to members, I'm not prolonging your stay here. Suffice to say, we will be meeting next Wednesday, notwithstanding that it's a committee week, because we've made the change with EDD. So we are meeting next Wednesday, and I will give you the time. Is it 9 or 10? That will be coming. Thank you. Honourable Hill Lewis?
Chair, the Secretary will be in touch about the subcommittee.
Yes. Well, I hope, you know, as soon as we have the names, we don't even have a full group yet, do we? But I know that Mr. Herman's with Mr. Mabasa. I hope we can have it Wednesday afternoon, the first one, because we'll meet in the morning, and why not continue with a subcommittee or something like that. But I do not want to dictate the time to the subcommittee. Thank you. Thank you, members.